Welcome to DC Special Cast, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Paul Ken. This podcast is an exploration of DC's special comics of the Bronze Age, which included such titles as the aptly named DC Special and Special Series, but also DC Superstars, Super DC Giant, Four Star Superhero Spectacular, and others. If you've read any of these comics, you know that they varied wildly in content, quality, and even format. They featured every possible genre of the comics industry at that time. If you're listening to this episode the day it drops, it's July 5th, so I hope everybody had a great sesquicentennial yesterday. I got that right. Well, I'm impressed. In honor of that, we have an episode starring the original super team, the Justice Society of America. And who better to discuss this with than the host of too many podcasts to name, but specifically the JSA in the 90s, the real grand poobah of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, the irredeemable Shag. Hey, Shag, welcome to DC Special Cast. I'm glad you finally made time to come on the show. I've been trying to get you on forever.
Thank you so much, Paul. I'm thrilled to be here. But first, let's rewind the tape a little bit. First of all, thank you for saying the real grand poobah. That's appreciated. That's a callback to a couple episodes ago. You guys probably, hopefully, have wiped from your memory, and now people know where the real power lies. But more importantly, you said, if I heard you right, I think you said you appreciated I finally made time.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you've been trying to get you on here for, you know, a year and a half. I mean, what are we gonna do?
Oh really? Is that what you do right out of the gate? You just lie to your listeners? Because pretty much right after you joined the network, all right, I had you on a very special episode of Who's Who, which is called Who's That? We discussed Nightshade. We had a great time.
That was a fun episode. I enjoyed that a lot. That was fun.
At least half the people talking were good. Anyway, I just figured that that would result in a reciprocal invitation for me. And here we sit nearly 4 years later, and you finally deemed to have me on. I mean, I'm so honored, you know, Paul, to appear on episode, wait, let me check, episode 19. Gosh, thank you.
You're welcome. Happy to have you. I'm sure you will be no worse than my 19th best guest so far. So that's just great.
Oh, you're such a charmer.
I am. I do have to ask you, Shag, where does your love of the Justice Society come from? Yeah, I know you've talked about it a little bit on other shows, but you are kind of a post-crisis guy, unlike me, who spans both years. But loving the original Golden Age team is kind of a funny thing. Tell listeners about it.
Sure. And I think that's quaint the way you describe yourself. You can just say old. It's okay. So for me, I started reading comics in the Bronze Age, and crisis was a major thing for me. But I got a lot of comics before that, just as a kid. Like, my very first Justice League comic was issue 171. I was age 7, and that was the death of Mr. Terrific. It was a JSA-JLA team-up. That was the first time I ever saw the JSA. I was fascinated by them. Like, here's these guys I know from Super Friends, but they look different. Green Lantern's got blonde hair. What happened? By the way, it took me like 10 or 15 years to get part 2 of that story to find out what happened. But anyway, so then I get to Crisis on Earth, and I start making all these lists. I was a kid of lists, man. I had these notebooks full of reams of paper, like Earth 1, okay, Superman. And then over here, Earth 2. Another Superman. You know, I wrote all this stuff down just so I could keep it straight. Then those Superpowers miniseries come out, like by Jack Kirby with the Dr. Fate issues, which I loved. I read more of the JLA-JSA crossovers. Crisis on Earth Prime, I still think, is one of the greatest crossovers ever. Then, 1990, that's when it finally clicked for me. I was going through our quarter bins and 50-cent bins in the stores where I shopped, and I came across a huge run of the All-Star Comics revival from the Bronze Age. And I bought them all, and I read them, and I loved them. And I think what it was is this is the first time I ever read a JSA book where they were the stars, not the guest stars. You know, this was their world. They were the celebrities, and these were their adventures, and I just loved it. So that's where it happened. The question as to why it happened, I think it's because, I mentioned Super Friends, right? Like, I grew up on Super Friends. All of those characters are just in my DNA. Everyone knows the Justice League, right? But here we read the JSA, and they're so much alike of our heroes of the JLA, just slightly adjacent, you know? The JSA feels like an alternate version, kind of askew. And for a lot of years, you know, us hardcore fans were the only ones who really cared about those JLA adjacent characters. So it was kind of this kind of cool feeling, you're rooting for the underdogs and stuff. And then the other component, as time goes on, is the legacy idea. You know, they become the elder statesmen or the stateswomen of the DC universe. They bring in the next generation, even starting as early as that Bronze Age stories, you know, with the Super Squad. They bring in the next generation of heroes. And I just love that aspect of it. And I feel like DC in post-crisis, really legacy was their biggest victory. It was great. You said I'm a post-crisis guy. That is absolutely true. So actually, even though I do love Golden Age JSA, I actually prefer post-crisis JSA. I prefer it without Superman, without Batman. And my JSA Wonder Woman is Polly, not Diana.
No, I hear you. I get it. Listen, the stories post-crisis, you know, especially the Geoff Johns run, are to the modern reader vastly superior than the ones that were coming out. Time, no question about that. And you're absolutely right. The legacy aspect is tremendous. And I love that run too. But my first exposure was in those JLA JSA crossovers too. And I picked up the All-Star run as it was coming out. But before we get too much farther, I do want to take a moment to thank our sponsors. This episode of DC Specialcast is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 40% off with free shipping to orders of $50 or more. So Shag, this may be an unfamiliar thing for you, but did you bring a recommendation for our listeners?
I was going to say, what is this in-stock trades thing you speak of? How fascinating. Well, I did happen to go to their website for the first time in my life, and I found a fantastic book to recommend. I would like to recommend JSA. This is the 2024 edition of that book, Trade Paperback Volume 3, also called Year 1. So this is the story that collects JSA 13 through 18 that just finished, actually. It's the first days of the Justice Society. It's all about them coming together. It's obviously a modern retelling, but you get Jeff Lemire's writing, you get Gavin Goodry on the artwork. It's a gorgeous book. It's really enjoyable. I'm going to talk a little more about it later, so I'm going to save a lot of what I'm going to say right now. But it's published by DC Comics, written by Jeff Lemire, again, art by Gavin Goodry, cover arts by Dave Johnson. It's 144 pages. It's actually not out yet, but by the time you guys hear this, it'll be out in about a month, around August 11th. List price is $17.99, but with the in-stock trades discount of 40%, you should only pay $10.79. Heck of a deal for six great issues, and it's a different version of the story we're going to talk about today.
Very cool. Excellent choice. My choice is, because I love the DC Finest line, I had to go with the DC Finest Justice Society of America for America and Democracy trade paperback, written by Gardner Fox with lots of different artists. And it is the very first adventures of the original super team, the Justice Society of America, from winter 1940 to September 1942, featuring Golden Age classics. It collects All-Star Comics from 3 to 12. It is a $39.99 cover price. You save 42% on in-stock trades, so it only costs you $23.19, and that is a steal for those great stories.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right, so what are we talking about today? Well, we are talking about the last issue of DC Special, number 29, The Untold Origin of the Justice Society of America.
Last issue? Really?
The last issue of DC Special. Now, DC Special series continued on for a number of years later, but DC Special, which started out all reprints, then got a mixed. You know, we've covered most of the last few, which were the disasters, but this one is the last issue. They just continued on with DC Special Series instead.
Okay, but going out on a high note.
Going out on a high note, the most remembered one, I'm sure. Cover date was August, September 1977, but it was on sale May 12th of 1977. Cover price, 60 cents. 48-page count, edited by Joe Orlando. You have a physical copy, so you picked it up out of the back issue bins?
Yeah, I would have got this, again, around 1990s when I was buying as many JSA back issues as I could, so I probably got this out of a 50-cent bin or a quarter bin, I would assume, yeah.
Well, mine cost me the 60 cents. I did as a little 12-year-old boy, picked it up a number of years ago, probably 10 or 15 years ago, and probably at the Baltimore Comic Con. Mine is signed by the writer Paul Levitz and the artist Joe Staton on top of this gorgeous Neil Adams cover.
And he's only shown it to me like four times already, folks, just to brag.
There it is. There,
oh,
it, there, is, it,
there
is,
it is again.
It is.
Yep. I'm just telling you, bragging is a form of bullying, Paul.
Oh, I should say it was inked by Bob Layton, another superstar. Special note that in the credits, it is dedicated to Gardner Fox and Shel Lemire, who, quote, started it all in All-Star Comics number 3 of winter 1940. It's been reprinted a number of times in the Best of DC Digest number 21 from 1982, the Justice Society trade paperback 2006. They're the ones that had those Brian Bolland covers, which is great. Mm-hmm. Showcase presents All-Star Comics. And, of course, the hardcover, All-Star Comics Only Legends Live Forever from 2019, which is also another great hardcover collection. And good news, yes, this comic is available to read on DC Universe Infinite. And Shag has pulled his up. And, oh, look, your iPad signed by Joe Staton? No, no. I guess looking at the value of this book, Wayne Special Investments, this runs anywhere from 10 to 50 bucks or more, depending on condition. Pretty wide range, and it's very readily available. I think it sold pretty well. I did see one on eBay that was a CGC 9.6. They wanted 175 bucks for it, which is a bit much. It is a great Neil Adams cover, so if you wanted it just for that, that seems a bit steep to me.
I'm happy with my 50-cent investment.
Me too, with my 60 cents. Or my dad's, probably.
Oh, come on. You were raking leaves. Come on. You know it.
So in May 1977, let's turn to the timeline. I was just turned 12 years old, so it was prime time for comic reading, and there were some great books on the stands. For DC, we had part two of The Atom's Quest for Jean Loring and Super Team Family, number 12. She's not worth it, Ray. She's just not worth it. Although I love that story, you know, there's people on me to start including Super Team Family in the show. We'll see about that later this year.
I was just going to say, if only there was a Super Team Family podcast.
We also had the first new issue of Aquaman, number 57, that had that awesome Jim Aparo cover, and Showcase 94 with the debut of the new Doom Patrol, also with a Jim Aparo cover, but insides were by Joe Staton as well. The big book, of course, was Limited Collector's Edition C-51, the epic Ra's al Ghul Saga in Treasury form with that unbelievable Neil Adams cover. That was where I read those stories for the first time. I still have my copy as well as the facsimile that came out a couple of years ago. And over at Marvel, there were some great books as well. Amazing Spider-Man 171, that Wallcrawler had a guest star named Nova, who I had never heard of, and it was continued into Nova number 12. It worked for me because, you know, the one and only issue of Nova I bought was number 12. We also got Godzilla number 1 and Fermax the Human Fly number 1.
Aww.
Outside of Marvel and DC, Mike shows a lot of those modern comics reprints of Charlton Comics, like Blue Beetle number 1. I've seen a couple of those in the cheap bins, picked up a couple over the years, but I don't recall buying any of them off the stands. So I just read through a whole bunch, but how about you, Shaggy? You know, you were younger at the time. You weren't buying comics on your own, but anything jump out at you?
Yeah, I would probably read a comic if it was sitting around back then, but I wasn't actively buying myself. But I went through Mike's Amazing World, and I did look at issues that I picked up since then down the line. And of course, you mentioned that Aquaman issue. That one's near and dear to my heart. I was a big Aquaman collector. But come on, man. I mean, you just talked for like 5 minutes about the month of May 1977, one of the single most important months in geek culture ever. And you didn't even mention the fact that a little movie came out that month called Star Wars. And that's relevant because on the stands of that month was Star Wars number 2, which was the second issue of 6 adapting the movie. It was kind of surprising that they actually released the adaptation, at least issues 1 and 2, before the movie came out. That's kind of, I mean, that would never happen nowadays, but it's kind of crazy.
I did not buy the first 6 issues of Star Wars because I got them all in the Treasury edition
Ah,
reprints.
okay.
That I think the two of them, the first three and the second three. And then I bought every issue from 7 to 107, whenever it ended. At this point in time, I was probably blissfully unaware of Star Wars.
Honestly, I wasn't either. I mean, I would have been too until my brother saw it, I think within a week or so of it coming out, you know, and that's when it just went nuts. But it wasn't until it came out that I even probably heard of it. So, anyway, other ones on the stand, Starfire number 7, which was this great sci-fi fantasy series by Steve Englehart and Mike Vosburgh. Now, not an issue I necessarily bought, but it's worth noting Iron Fist number 14 was on the shelves by Chris Claremont and John Byrne. That is the very first appearance of Sabretooth. And that book probably goes for a fortune nowadays, I'd imagine, but that's kind of a big deal. Also on the shelves the same month, just by sheer coincidence, Marvel Team Up number 60, which is Spider-Man and the Wasp, also by Chris Claremont and John Byrne. But that is the very exact issue Siskoid and I will be covering next on the Fire and Water Team Up when we record together. So it's kind of cool.
Very
And
cool.
sadly, the most disappointing thing was there was only one Sad Sack comic on the shelves that month, which is incredibly disappointing. He had like 4 or 5 different ongoing titles, so I think he deserved more that month. But anyway.
But he's a sad second to Richard H.
Yeah. Wah, 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 wah.
Thanks, as always, to my favorite comics website, Mike's Amazing World of Comics. Shag, would you like to describe the cover and comment on it by the legendary Neil Adams?
Absolutely. Okay, so we've got a banner head across the top. This is DC Special, the untold origin of Justice Society. And the words Justice Society are the logo in blue and yellow. And I believe that logo is from the later All-Star Comics Bronze Age issues, I'm pretty sure. Then you've got another shout-out burst saying, "The most sensational secret of World War II." I'm weird. They spelled out the word two in World War II. And to me, it's always supposed to be II. Anyway, now the cover features no backgrounds. There's just this solid sort of orange. Well, I guess it's a bit of a gradient. It's an orange color, starts as a strong orange at the top, and then turns a little more pale by the bottom, but no backgrounds at all. Then moving from left to right, we have our Justice Society heroes. You know, we've got Alan Scott, Green Lantern. We've got Jay Garrick, The Flash. We've got Al Pratt, The Atom. We've got Hawkman, Spectre, Dr. Fate, Hour Man, Batman, Superman. The heroes are running and flying into the fray to face on the right-hand side the Valkyrie warriors that are sitting there on their winged steeds. In fact, the Atom, he's got there first, and is dishing out some fist-shaped consequences to one particular flying horse. I thought he was punching the Valkyrie, but then I realized, no, he's punching the horse in the face.
I figure Superman must have thrown him or something.
Maybe. It looks like Spectre did, really, by the placement of all of it. But either way. Then in the middle, as you mentioned, Superman is there. And he's got the Earth 2 S-Shield there, so that's obvious who he is. And he's flying towards the battle, but at the same time, he is punching this enormous bomb that is covered in swastikas that's fallen from the sky. And finally, in the bottom, in the foreground, the largest figure on the cover here, we have a rendition of Adolf Hitler himself. He's leaning back slightly with his fist raised, his eyes are closed in defiance as he shouts to the heavens. And his left hand is some kind of spear, which by the story's end, we will of course know it's the infamous Spear of Destiny, but at this point, kids probably didn't know what that was. And more importantly, in fact, most importantly, there's a banner ad just tucked along in the bottom right-hand corner that says, "You could be in the Superman movie. Details inside." Now, personally, I'm still holding out hope that I'm going to win the contest. I just, fingers crossed. I think the date's passed, but I'm hoping it's going to be me.
Yeah, this is just a great cover. Who would have thought that the Spear of Destiny becomes so important?
Right.
Years go by. You got all the heroes, really classic looks.
A couple things I want to add. It feels pretty uncomfortable to say this, but that's a good-looking Hitler.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying.
Weird statement.
I'll take that out of context and edit it just so that...
I would love that. Thank you so much. It is solely a compliment to Neil Adams' drawing style. Also, one thing of note, the Sandman, he's the only JSA-er missing from the cover, which is a little weird.
Yeah, that is weird.
And then I think just looking at this, and I'm looking at the digital version, so I've got a much better view of it than the, because the physical comic, you know how printing works, it bleeds a little bit, it spreads over time, it even gets worse. So if you look at the digital scans, Neil Adams' line work is really, really thin. It almost looks like he used the same size pen nub for the whole thing instead of varying sizes. Now, the printed version, again, it looks better. The lines look thicker and everything. But it just, I don't know, there's something about it. It almost looks like how Gil Kane used to draw towards the end of his career. Everything looked very thin lined. But anyway.
I didn't notice that, but you're right. And it doesn't credit either on the cover or at Mike's. It doesn't say anybody else inked it. So I assume Neil inked it himself. A lot of times it'd be Dick Giordano. But it doesn't say that. Dick Giordano kind of usually rounds him out a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a great looking cover. I will say it is one of these ones that could have been square bound because on the side, they have the little white strip, kind of like the dust jacket of a book where it says DC Special, yeah. 60 Cents, Origin of the Dust Society. So I think that's kind of cool. I always like it when they had those. And the ones that are glued instead of stapled, they would stand out a little more on the stands, that kind of thing. So I don't know if they thought this might have been one where they would have glued it, but either way, it's kind of a cool cover.
They might have been thinking about throwing some stuff in the back and
right.
making it a square bound 100 pager or something. It could have been. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. If they had done that, they could have put the actual first appearance of the Justice Society behind it. And there you would have had a nice giant size, even bigger giant size than what this
Gianter
size. So, of course, I will post the cover. Plenty of other pages from this comic on the gallery page for DC Special Cast at fireandwaterpodcast.com. So we're going to jump into the story. As I said, written by Paul Levitz, art by Joe Staton and Bob Layton. The Untold Origin of the Justice Society, I will mention. The featured characters were Superman, Batman, Flash, Hawkman, Green Lantern, Atom, Sandman, Hourman, Spectre, and Dr. Fate. Shag, would you like to do the honors and summarize the story for our listeners?
Absolutely. Here we go, folks. Strap in. It's a good one. After a fantastic splash page of the current, as of 1977, lineup of the JSA, we are taken back to November 1940. We see a clandestine meeting of President Roosevelt and British intelligence agent Smythe, who informs the president that Germany is preparing to invade England within weeks. He asks for help, but Roosevelt reiterates that he's promised not to enter the war unless America is attacked. But FDR has an alternative for Smythe, the mystery men who've recently been appearing across America. So Smythe travels to Gotham City, where Commissioner Gordon has facilitated a meeting for him with Batman, Flash, and Green Lantern. The three heroes undertake a secret mission against fifth columnists in Scotland, but are defeated by Helmut Stryker and his giant Nazi robot. The heroes are taken to Berlin to be executed by Adolf Hitler, who has discovered the Spear of Destiny, which supposedly pierced the side of Christ on the cross and has magical powers. But Dr. Fate has learned of their capture and takes Hourman with him to free the heroes. But Hitler uses the spear to summon Valkyries from the Asgardian plane to battle them. He then also commands the invasion of England to begin immediately. Fate then summons for no apparent reason. Sandman, Adam, and Hawkman, but don't worry, he did summon the Spectre as well. He summons them from America to help the British successfully repel the German naval attack at Dover. With his plans thwarted, Hitler demands that an experimental long-range bomber be deployed immediately with the Valkyries as escorts. Their target? Washington, D.C. The heroes battle the Valkyries across the ocean but are unable to slow the bomber. Just as they approach Washington, D.C., it looks like the darkest hour, but they are saved by Superman. He jumps up to destroy the bomber and the bomb, and Washington is saved. Or is it? Because in the confusion, a lone Valkyrie has found her way into the Oval Office. As she is about to blast the president, the Atom jumps in front of him and takes the blast. Their mission having failed, all the Valkyries disappear into the ether. The president then suggests that the heroes remain together as an army regiment, but Superman declines to be part of the military unit. The Spectre and Dr. Fate foresee perils ahead that they must confront as a team. So they decide they shall fight in the cause of justice, naming their group the Justice Society of America. There we go, Paul. That's about the best summation I can get from a summary that you wrote. Thank you very much, by the way.
That was great. You know, we might as well just walk through it bit by bit and make our points as we go through. Nicely split up into chapters. Thank you, Paul Levitz, for doing that. It makes us podcasting 40 years later a lot easier, or almost 50 years later a lot easier.
I'm sure that was at the forefront of Paul's mind when he wrote this, is I want to help the podcasters of the future.
Yeah, I'll ask him next time I interview him. So the first page I want to talk about for a second, because I love this splash page. They've got a little blurb at the top, which I do want to read, because it says, "In winter of 1940, Adolf Hitler abandoned plans to invade England. To this day, no one knows why. No one but the 10 heroes who battled across two continents to ruin those plans and give birth to a legend. At last, the untold origin of the Justice Society." So we'll hear more about that in our special feature at the end. But what we've got here is the current day Justice Society. By current day, obviously 1977. You've got the traditional heroes in the back. You've got even Mr. Terrific and Dr. Midnight and Johnny Thunder and the Thunderbolt. Ma Hunkle Red Tornado's peeking out from behind Wonder Woman. And there's the other Red Tornadoes there, along with Wonder Woman and the Spectre, Starman and the Black Canary next to each other, probably holding hands. And then you've got the Atom and Sandman in his traditional costume, which I like. And then you've got Dr. Fate, Flash, Hawkman, Power Girl, Hourman, Star Spangled Kid, Wildcat, Green Lantern, and the Earth 2 Robin. Fantastic splash page by Joe Staton. I mean, I don't know. What's your take on this page here, Chad?
It's absolutely gorgeous. Absolutely gorgeous. And I mentioned earlier, you know, the Super Squad era, the Bronze Age All-Star Comics was my first time I really fell in love with the JSA, and this is them. You know, you got the Super Squad right here in the front. Power Girl, Star Spangled Kid, Robin. Wait a minute, where's Huntress? Wait,
Huntress wasn't born yet. I mean, she was born, but she wasn't in Huntress yet. There's no Huntress yet.
Okay,
I didn't think about it. May of 1977. So the Huntress first appeared in DC Superstars number 17. That wasn't on sale until August 25th, 1977, which is 4 months after this comic came out.
Wow. Okay, see.
And that was concurrent with All-Star issue number 69. All-Star still had a few issues to run where she was in there and she teamed up with Wildcat and that whole storyline. Came in after this story. That's why there's no Huntress on this page.
So, wow, that blows my mind. Okay, see, thank you for explaining all that, because I really was wondering where Huntress was just then. But okay, back to this. I love seeing Robin in this Earth 2 costume. It's goofy, but I love this particular version of it. It's great to see Joe Staton draw Power Girl. I mean, he has such a footprint on that character. I do think it's a little strange that he hid. Now, Ma Hunkle being hid makes sense because she was never really part of the team. But the other Red Tornado, he was part of the team. There's no reason necessarily to hide him. It's cute, though, having them on both sides of Wonder Woman. It's nice to see Black Canary there. I mean, a lot of people probably forgot that Black Canary was a JSA member by this point. So yeah, overall, it's a great piece. Even Mr. Terrific's represented, which is wonderful.
Yep, it's fantastic. We turn the page and we get a two-page prologue starring FDR and this guy, Agent Smythe. Now, I think it's pretty cool. FDR mentions, I trust Intrepid as well. And so I actually Googled Intrepid and Mr. Stevenson. And holy cow, listeners, this is the guy that really inspired James Bond, who was the liaison between British intelligence and U.S. intelligence during beginning parts of World War II and throughout most of World War II. So just go Google it. I'm not going to do a profile on it, but wow, very impressive guy in real life.
I did the same research because there was enough there to make you think this feels there's more here, unless it's from a spy comic. But yeah, real deal. So well done, Paul Levitz.
Very impressive. I surprised I never really knew much about him before, but it was pretty cool to read about him. FDR declines. America's not entering the war yet. And he shows them pictures of some of the mystery men. And so Smythe takes off for Gotham City, We get chapter one. The first character we see is Batman. The Bat Signal summoned them to police headquarters, and he comes in, and there's Green Lantern and Flash waiting for him. So what do you think about this chapter?
Artistically, I love that Joe Staton draws the bat symbol so big. I just love that giant bat symbol on Batman. I think that looks really cool. I wish we'd see that more often, especially without the yellow oval. It just looks really, really nice. It's an interesting scene. I gotta ask big picture, though. Having read the whole comic, I don't understand why Batman is included in the first wave. I don't understand why they identified him to be a critical person. From a story writing perspective, like Paul Levitz's perspective, I could totally get if he was going to go for like his intelligence or his detective work or whatever. But realistically, all Batman does is throw a couple punches in this comic. And his dialogue doesn't even feel particularly very Batman-y. He's just a guy ready for a fight.
You put that in the notes. I was thinking about it. I think it's because these are the guys that they were able to contact right away. Time was of the essence. So they know how to contact Batman. They use a bat signal. Green Lantern was also in Gotham City. So I can imagine that Commissioner Gordon had a way to contact him, if possible, even though we've never really heard that. And maybe Green Lantern reached out to the Flash once he heard, you know, the summons. They were looking for speed at first to get over to Scotland. That's just my little headcanon. But
yeah,
maybe that helps assuage your problems a little bit there, Shane.
Well, I mean, if I'm going to be totally pedantic nerdy here, right? Like, I mean, Flash and Green Lantern were pretty high profile, so probably there's ways to get in touch with them. But really, I think by this point, everyone would know, just go talk to the people at the Daily Star and you could find Superman. That would be a pretty easy one to get to.
The story writing idea was they wanted to save Superman for the big thing at the end. I think that's why we don't see Superman at the beginning.
It's totally worth it. It's totally worth it, that ending. So either way, okay. But yes, it's a nice chapter. I like them meeting, you know, and all that sort of dark and closing doors and, you know, spies sitting in shadows and all that. So it's fun.
Then we get chapter two. I have to say this, and this happened too when Sean Ross and I reviewed the Wonder Woman Spectacular, which took place in Earth 2 and World War II. They were back and forth across the Atlantic like several times during that story, like no times. And there's a lot of quick traveling in this story too. So we'll allow that for the artistic license. I just want to point that out because it is funny. So they're quickly, they make it to Scotland and they're going to this castle, which apparently the Germans are using as sort of an advanced base for their invasion, which is happening several hundred miles to the south. I don't quite understand the geographical importance of this Scottish castle. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
No, they just say they're fifth column. But yeah, I mean, they have all this giant machinery and robots. All I can think is it's probably just a factory for building this giant robot. And it just so happens they know the invasion plans. I'm going to guess that's probably what it is.
Well, they do say that they are going there to try to figure out the date of the invasion. So they want to be prepared for the invasion.
Yeah.
So I get why the heroes are going there. But then, yeah, the best part of it is there's a giant robot and you always like superheroes battling a giant robot, but they don't fare too well because the giant robot just takes out Batman pretty easy and then clobbers the Flash right into Green Lantern. They're all out cold.
They come off like chumps here. I mean, Batman, yeah. I get it. He's a regular dude. You got a giant Nazi robot. That's fine. The Batman's going down. Flash actually takes himself out. He runs at the robot and basically bounces off of him and then knocking himself out. And he goes flying into Green Lantern. They really do come off like chumps here. I mean, it's obviously, again, it's storytelling driven, but it's like, oh, come on, you know, guys. Now, I'm going to fuss and point out stuff like that throughout here, but I want to make sure people understand I love this comic, okay? I'm having fun. I'm poking holes in it for a laugh, if nothing else, but this comic's great.
No, I hear you. We then get an interlude from Salem, Massachusetts, where Dr. Fate finally decides to join the party, and he grabs our man for some reason, and they quickly travel to Berlin, where we find chapter three, the next chapter. So here's where we get our first view of Hitler ranting and raving in front of, I mean, this is a giant stadium. Now, the heroes are little tiny figures on top of this, what's that, 50-foot tall podium there?
It's something, it's probably 30, but yeah, 30 feet up in the air on a podium, yep.
Giant crowds behind them, and he's ranting and raving with the Spear of Destiny in his hand. And we get a very helpful, oh, what's the Spear of Destiny? And see Weird War Tales number 50 for more details by Joe Orlando. Now, and it's not much to it. It's just a story about what the Spear of Destiny was. And it's the spear that supposedly pierced the side of Jesus when he was up on the cross. And so it's got magical powers. And they're It was also supposed to be cursed, and it was handed down from all these evil people had it throughout the years of history in that story.
I'm sure that was addressed by our friends over at the Weird Warriors podcast at some point.
I'm sure it has. Good call out.
We're getting into the Dr. Fate stuff, and I don't really get to talk about him very often, but he's one of my all-time favorite characters. I have a top eight of favorite characters. I don't know why it's eight, but it is. Anyway, Dr. Fate is always like in the top five. I love this character, especially as he was in the late 70s. I know this is the 40s, but this is still the 1970s portrayal of him. Such a top-tier, awesome character. I love it, and I'm so excited to see his tower, see him with Hourman, and now see him here in Berlin. It makes me so happy.
It's cool. A lot of neat touches here. Now, I don't know if this is the letterer who was Bill Morse, who I'm not familiar with. It says chapter three is Berlin and the Berlin, Germany, and the Berlin and the Germany are, they're dripping blood, and the swastikas there are dripping blood. Now, it's all black because you weren't allowed to use red in the Comics Code era for blood. It's dripping with, this is a dangerous place to be for our heroes. Hitler goes and yanks off Batman's cowl, and there's another cowl underneath. I'm like, what? Just like in Batman Family, he's always taking a mask off, there's a cowl underneath. No, it's Dr. Fate's magic.
It's so funny and stupid. And Batman's got like a grin, and like he knows the gig, and it's just hilarious. I love it. Hourman starts bragging a little too much, though.
I know. Where's Hourman getting off talking smack? But Dr. Fate tells him, you shouldn't have spoken so soon, Hourman. Do not taunt a foe till he has truly fallen. Like, that's pretty cool.
I love that Dr. Fate's endorsing taunting a foe after you've taken him out, too. Here's a little bit of retconniness I want to point out. So Dr. Fate in 1940 wasn't portrayed this way. Okay, so here he's shooting Ankh bolts. He's talking very more almost third person-y sort of thing. This is a 1970s version of Dr. Fate, not a 1940s version. And by the way, if the JSA are now awake, why couldn't Flash vibrate through those ropes? And why isn't Alan Scott just knocking down everybody with his ring? I don't get that.
Alan Scott doesn't get to do a whole lot in this comic either. You know, again, it's okay. They're trying to mix a lot of things up in this. What I do like is the heroes start to defeat the troops. Hitler starts raising the spear and screaming and yelling. And then the Valkyries start coming in. There are these blonde warrior women and big white winged horses with costumes with big V-neck. And they're all quite buxom. It's just, it's a riot. They are being controlled by the Spear of Destiny and who holds it.
I just love, folks, how Paul was very carefully dancing around the fact that these women are smoking hot, okay? And there is a lot of cleavage going on here. I mean, Joe Staton in the 70s, he could draw a very healthy, sexy woman, and he has done that here, folks. Let me tell you.
Yeah, he's not shy about it. So there's a big battle going on. Hitler says, you know what? To heck with it. Let's start the invasion of England tonight. Then we get a kind of a weird page. We got Berlin, Normandy, where the ships are taking off to go over to Dover. And then Glasgow again. This is the last we hear of the guy in Glasgow. So again, I don't know why he's so important. The heroes are really tied up here. So what does Dr. Fate do? He says, I need somebody to help stop the invasion. That gets us to chapter four.
I just want to say that page of the map. First of all, I love a map. I love a map in a comic book. Joe Staton gives us a full page of this with the little inset pictures. I love it. And in particular, I love they gave Dr. Fate a nickname. They call him the heir to the Millennium of Magics. And I'm like, ooh, a lot of M's, but I really like that. Makes me very happy. So yes, as Paul has explained here, and I said a little bit in the recap, so they're losing. They need help. So if Green Lantern can't do it, and Flash can't do it, and Dr. Fate can't do it, well, of course, Wesley Dodds, the Sandman, Al Pratt, the Atom, and Carter Hall, the Hawkman, they're your go-tos.
Yeah, absolutely.
Even the narrator makes fun of it. The narrator says, even the German High Command, had they but known, might not have feared the imminent arrival of three heroes so much weaker than those already in battle. Doesn't really track.
The Sandman, he gets a whole page to himself, which I think is kind of funny. His MO is pretty much the same. He's knocking out a thug. He sprinkles some sand, leaving a note for the police, and then gets yanked by one of Dr. Fate's magical cords, and they yank them all the way across the ocean. Again, this has to be really fast, right?
Yes.
All the way across the ocean to Dover, England.
Hawkman does comment that it's faster than he could fly. He's Hawkman. How fast can he really fly? But either way, yeah, it's got to be like, you know, wind-breaking pace or whatever it is. Now, I do want to ask about Sandman. I don't know if you noticed this. You mentioned he's sprinkling sand, right? Throughout the entire comic, his only weapon is sand. He doesn't use his gas gun.
Nope.
Like, I don't get it. Was there something going on in the 40s where he wasn't using his gas gun or something? I'm confused.
Well, he does have his gas gun then. I don't know whether he stopped using it at some point, but at this this point, he should have it, unless it's before he invented it, which is possible. Because he's so new at it, it's possible.
Could be. Then I guess he's just knocking them out with a punch or something. Well, actually, he throws sand at people later and implies that it's going to make them fall asleep. So it's almost like the sand itself is the sleep, whatever.
I don't know. If any of our listeners have a better history of that, let me know. Maybe it's something probably I should know, but I don't.
Oh, I'm sure these old nerds are writing in already, telling me how wrong they are.
Thanks, Martin. The bottom page of 17, we do get a, but then, dear leader, they did not see Dr. Fate send forth a fourth enchanted tentacle or the faint ghostly image of the fourth hero. Now we're talking big guns here.
Yes.
The Germans have immediately arrived in Dover, and you see the big white cliffs there. The British are so excited to see the Atom and Sandman arrive on their shores, like you just said. But they start battling them, and they start to drive back the first wave. But then they look out, and there's tons of ships. There's no way they can stop all these ships.
But who shows up?
But the Spectre, and he's going to take care of them. But then we cut back in Chapter 6, back to Berlin, and the tide is turning. Dr. Fate's had a chance to rest. Green Lantern's been holding them off. Batman and Hourman aren't really doing anything. So the tide is turning. Now, out of the blue, Hitler approaches some other scientist guy and says, the experimental bomber, send that off to Washington and blow up the Capitol and kill the president. Yeah, I've got this thing going on in England. It doesn't matter. Let's send that off. And the guy's like, but it'll set the war effort back years with our experimental bomber. And he says, I don't care. Send it. Get it done. And then we see the Valkyries leave the battle and start sort of escorting that plane. So what do you think of this whole sequence?
Well, the Spectre arriving is great because just before that, we see this fleet and the heroes have admitted they don't have a chance against the fleet. So seeing the Spectre arrive is a big, ooh, hooray moment. But then that shot in Berlin, a lot of time must have passed because they're literally talking about how everyone's taking breaks. Green Lantern and Dr. Fate are spelling for each other. Then Dr. Fate gets out there and starts throwing spells that the Valkyrie aren't ready for because he's recharged. And then, Hitler's insanity, which is great. And this really is. I mean, it's like a summer blockbuster. It's like, okay, yes, we've got the Valkyries. Yes, we've got the invasion of England. What the hell? Let's throw in an attack on the United States as well. I mean, it's everything that you could possibly throw in here, which is exactly what you want in the comic.
I always like a giant specter. Now he's there stopping all these ships, pushing them back, and puts the fear of God into the commander. And all the ships are either sunk or sent back to Germany in a quick span of 2 pages. He takes care of them all. Why did Dr. Fate need anybody else other than the Spectre? I don't know.
Well, that's always the case. Spectre's a one-man team by himself. In fact, these pages either get referenced or homaged a whole bunch. Because if you read the Spectre series, they'll flash back to World War II from time to time. And it's always showing the Spectre manhandling battleships. That's always the moment where they want to demonstrate how powerful he is. I don't know if this is the first time they ever showed that. I imagine they probably showed something in the 40s like this. But to see Spectre manhandling battleships is always wow.
Not that long before this was the Michael Fleischer, Jim Perro adventure comics. I don't think there was any battleships in that, but big time in that in terms of his magical constructs. And
compared to like the 60s stuff, even that was a little earthbound. There was some 60s stories where he's like smashing planets on a bad guy.
All good stuff. So then we get a nice little 2-page summary of the heroes. The ones from Germany have now arrived in Dover. They all sort of introduce themselves in the top of page 26, shaking hands. Dr. Fate putting them on alert. He says, my friends, we rejoice too quickly. I sense great evil. And then they see right above them the Valkyries and that bomber flying over their head, headed towards America.
Just happened to be in the right place at the right time.
I think that's great.
And this starts, interestingly enough, it's only a couple of pages, but this starts a running battle literally across the entire Atlantic Ocean. So this must have gone on for hours, this fight.
Yeah, that's cool. And you wonder, what did the heroes like the Atom and the Flash even and stuff like that, did they do in this battle? I guess they were just jumping from horse to horse rather than battling the Valkyries.
Well, they do show that there is a Green Lantern construct of like a giant flat scoop sort of shape. And that's where all the non-flying characters are hanging out.
Yeah. So they finally arrive at Washington, D.C., but they haven't been able to hold them back. They're making their way to Washington. They're going to do some real damage when Green Lantern says, no, it's incredible. We've got a reprieve. Look, leaping up from the press building. I love it. We get the kapow moment of Superman coming in. Big splash page. Superman coming up, smashing a couple bombers on page 29. And I love that it's the Joe Schuster, squinty-eyed Superman. Fantastic splash page. One of my favorite pages of all. I mean, really, this is just a great, great scene.
Oh, it's amazing. You get the Superman logo. You get him literally splitting that experimental bomber into Superman. Literally fills every inch of the page from his fist to the top to his feet to the bottom. It's incredible. The thing I love about the S is it is not specific to the Earth 2 S, but that is such a classic style S that it looks perfect. It's a wonderful page. I'm not even a huge Superman guy pre-crisis, but man, this is just a hell of a great page.
Yeah, it's fantastic. So he is able to destroy the bomber, but the bomb has already taken off. So he has to dive down and catch, and he catches it with a big oof.
Yep.
Which I love.
Well, and the important thing to note here too is Superman can't fly at this point.
Right.
Right. So he talks about how he leaps and then Dr. Fate helps him fall to catch it.
Yep. He's able to catch the bomb before it goes off. The battle's still going on. The heroes are battling, but there's one Valkyrie. She's sneaking in. And she's made her way to the White House, and she's trying to get in to assassinate the president. But the Atom, the lone hero, turning from the battlefield to the more terrible danger within. I love on this page, well, really both pages, 31 and 32, no dialogue. There's captions, but there's no dialogue on these pages. That picture on the top of 32, you've got the Valkyrie. She's in shadows, and she's got slat lines from a blind or something outlining her figure. She's clearly sneaking around, trying to get inside to accomplish her mission. She crashes through the glass. There's FDR with his cigar. She's about to blast him when the Atom comes crashing in. He takes a full blast before she can recover. Then Superman grabs her and the president is saved. Just a great scene.
Absolutely fantastic. And I love that it's the Atom. The little guy that no one has faith in is the one that saves the president. And this scene gets brought up time and time and time again throughout the history of JSA, talking about how Al Pratt saved the president. It's a big crowning moment for him. And I love to see it here because this is where they did it first. The little guy. The little guy's the one that does it, you know? Now, Superman had to be pretty careful, by the way, when he grabbed the Valkyrie, because there's not a lot of places to safely put his arms, given the way Joe Staten draws her. So he had to choke her on the neck, which is, you know, anyway. But good stuff. And FDR looks great. I love the way Joe Staten's drawn him. He's got his long cigarette holder, you know, bit down in his teeth, and he looks fantastic.
Yeah, he looks great. The Valkyries all disappear because they failed in their mission. We get the president congratulating them, said, boy, you'd make a swell battalion. Superman says, well, I'm not really comfortable working in the military, but instead we will bind ourselves together in the cause of justice, and we will call ourselves, and you turn the page to the final page of the story, the Justice Society of America, and you get another splash page of the team, just these 10 heroes. The Atom is there, and his costume's all ripped, which will make my podcast partner, Sean, very happy because he loves it when costumes are messed up. And the bookend comment is just the winter of 1940, Adolf Hitler abandoned plans to invade England. To this day, no one knows why. No one but the 10 heroes who battled across two continents to ruin those plans and give birth to a legend. Never the end. Fantastic ending to the story. And this is another fantastic splash page. I mean, you've got three major splash pages in this, the two bookends and the Superman ones, that all of which are classics in and of themselves.
Oh, it's a great page. And it's a great, like you said, bookend to the first one. Staten has a very cartoony style, and that's on purpose, right? Here, it's interesting. If you look in the splash pages, he draws people's heads very elongated. Again, in that cartoony style, and there's nothing wrong with it. But in the rest of the comic, he doesn't draw it as much that way. It's mostly in the splash pages. I don't know if it's because he spent more time on those and really was trying to focus on the stylized. I don't know. But I just noticed that Superman, he's got like Keith Giffen forehead kind of thing going on there. But yeah, it's great splash page. Absolutely looks fantastic.
Now, remember, Staten was really young at this point. He'd only been in the business a couple of years at this point. Now, he'd worked a couple of years over at Charlton, but we'll get more into him later.
Well, he's a hell of an artist at this point and just looks fantastic. Now, before we move on, we have to mention there's an ad in here that makes me ask a question for all of you at home. There's an ad in here for Crazy Crabs, which is where you can get your own hermit crab. They will mail it to you. I'm sure it loved going through the postal service. Anyway, it says these crabs can live to be 70 years old. So I want to know how many of you, and I'm looking at you, Terry O'Malley, how many of you people out there still have your crazy crabs and they're still alive? Because it says they can live 70 years. So write in, let us know, fireandwaterpodcast.com.
There you go.
Well, hold on. Before we move on, I do have one. I guess it's a nitpick. And it's not about this comic. It's about comics later. FDR is responsible for the formation of the JSA here. They make that plainly evident. Fast forward a few years, Roy Thomas writes All-Star Squadron, which we all love. But again, he makes FDR responsible for the All-Star Squadron. It just seems like a little too much. I get that FDR is an important key thing and he should be in the stories, but should he be responsible for all of that? Roy should have looked at that and gone, okay, Paul Levitz beat me to it. I'm not going to do it here. I don't know. It bugged me when I got to that.
Yeah, I think Roy did what he wanted to do and didn't care about that is kind of my thinking. He's like, I'm going to do it so it fits in exactly with every story that was written 35 years ago kind of thing. So I don't
Could
know.
be, could be.
I hear you. But I know you want to talk a little bit about the sort of legacy of this story, the things that have come since, because this was the first time that there was ever an origin of the Justice Society, but there have been a number of them since.
Yeah, that's right. So this one is published, again, DC Special 29, 1977. I wanted to point out that this version of the story, which is phenomenal, is not necessarily faithful to how the characters were reflected in the 1940s. Like Dr. Fate here is shooting Ankhs. He acts differently. Spectre is definitely a little bit different than he was in the 1940s. So there are some differences here. And I just want to point out that they were already retconning in 1977. And it's worth noting that this was written 37 years after their first appearance. Okay. The reason I'm saying all this is I'm going to get to in a minute. Fast forward about 10 years, you get Secret Origins number 31, 1988, which is a retelling of this story, a post-crisis version. They remove Superman and Batman because it's post-crisis. And in that version, FDR actually dies. And the Spectre argues with the voice of God for the life of FDR. It's pretty powerful stuff. As we established, I'm a post-crisis guy. But even I think this 1977 version is more entertaining as a story. This one's more fun to read.
I like the other one too, but I like this one better. Yeah. I agree.
And here's where the point I'm really trying to get to, which is we just ended a couple months ago in the current JSA series. There was a year one story. It started in 2025, finished in 2026. Jeff Lemire, I mentioned earlier, and it tells a completely different origin of the JSA. This is where I'm going to get on my soapbox, folks. I've seen online, I'm part of a lot of JSA groups, as you might imagine, because of my show and all this stuff. And I've seen a lot of unhappiness and frankly, downright spiteful hate directed at this JSA year one story for not keeping to the plot of this very DC special we just discussed. For me, I come at it from a different angle. The JSA has now been around for over 85 years. We can't even fathom what 85 years is. I mean, Paul's very close to that in age, but the rest of us, I mean, if for me, as long as you capture the spirit of the characters, you know, I'm fine with some reasonable changes. And I read JSA year one and I thought it was really damn good. I mean, I really enjoyed it. Again, I adore this DC special. I adore it. But I don't feel that beholden to it, like the continuity of it. Because, I mean, as we said, it was written 37 years after the JSA appeared. So even then, it was retconning stuff. So now it's been 49 years since this DC special was published. I think it's okay to do more retcon continuity, to let go of this retcon in favor of a new retcon. I'm just saying, I think if people would give the JSA year one story a chance, I think they would enjoy it. Sure, you can poke holes in it and be, oh, well, this character wouldn't have been around yet for this character. Guys, it's 85 years. Like, who cares? Just let it go. It's a great story. It captures the spirit of the characters, and I think it works.
Wholeheartedly agree. The DC universes have been rebooted like 10 times since this story has come out.
Right,
so
right.
Clearly, there's differences. This story's not going anywhere. I have this issue and it sits on my spinner rack. I look at it all the time when I'm down here and it's not going anywhere and I can pick it up and read it anytime I want.
Absolutely true. That's an important thing to say, too. You change continuity, the old comics are still there.
They're not going anywhere. I like old comics. I like new comics. I like all kinds of stuff. All right. Any final thoughts on the story as a whole?
No, just loved it. Absolutely loved it. I'm so glad I got a chance to revisit this. I have been asking Paul to do this episode before the damn show even started. And as you can see, it took till episode 19 for me to be invited, but I am thrilled that it finally got here.
Gotta have priorities.
I never liked you. Never liked you. In fact, I tried to vote you out of the network last month. Anyway,
before we do anything else, I want to give a profile on Joe Staton. Joe is a terrific artist. It's done many stories from the Bronze and Modern Ages of Comics that are just fantastic. I'll just mention that my sources were Joe's own website, joestaton.com, Wikipedia. There was a great interview from Comic Book Artist, and also Paul Kupperberg's book, Direct Conversations, which one of the interviews in that was by Joe Staton. If you haven't read any of those books, there are three of them. All DC is the two words in the title, and they're all available on Amazon. Sort of print on demand, I think. And they're all terrific. And they're all interviews from the time of the 70s and 80s when Kupperberg was the staffer at DC Comics. Joe Staton, he was born in 1948 in Tennessee. He was always into art. In the early 60s, he began drawing for science fiction fanzines, especially in what was called the Southern Fandom Press Alliance. He drew caricatures for his high school yearbook. And in college, he contributed editorial cartoons to both the official college newspaper and the alternative rag. In the late 60s and early 70s, he drew illustrations for the science fiction magazines Amazing and Fantastic.
So I'm going to read a quote here from Joe. He says, "As best as I recall, I've always wanted to do comics. I can remember sitting on the floor trying to trace Dick Tracy and the Phantom out of the Sunday funnies. My dad taught me to read from Superboy comics, and my long-suffering mother put up with me getting ink and paint all over the kitchen table.
I love that.
As for me getting into comics, we can blame Julie Schwartz. Back when I was 12 or so, he ran a couple of my letters in an early issues of JLA and Green Lantern, and he ran addresses. Bill Plott, a science fiction fan from Alabama, saw my letter and through that connection got into science fiction fandom, especially fanzine fandom.
Yeah, which is great. Joe graduated in 1970 from Murray State and started his comics career at Charlton Comics, 1971, where he co-created E-Mail and Michael Mauser, Private Eye, with writer Nicola Cutie. And there's a quote from that Direct Conversations book where Staton does say, he visited Charlton 1971 with his new bride. On his honeymoon, he stopped in for a job interview at Charlton, which I love. We were driving up to Mystic, Connecticut for a brief honeymoon. And since Charlton was in Derby, somewhat between Brooklyn and Mystic, and I had samples, I made an appointment with Sal Gentile. He let me come in, and I actually left there with scripts to draw. As soon as I got home, I got to work. So that's dedication on your honeymoon, right?
Lucky his wife stayed with him.
I was gonna say, in the mid-70s, Joe was hired by Roy Thomas to work at Marvel, and he inked the Hulk and the Avengers. While working at Charlton, I was taking my stuff around to Marvel and DC, but they weren't interested in me until one day, Roy Thomas called up out of the blue. We talked for an hour, and he asked if I would ink the Avengers. I said, yes. He says, that's good. It's on its way to you already. I caught Roy at Heroes Con a few years ago and asked him why he'd done that. Did he pick me out of a slush pile or had he seen my stuff? But he had no memory of even calling me. So says, Joe, I think we were just desperate. <That's> So Staton was then recruited to DC by Paul Levitz, who also called out of the blue, apparently, and that is where he produced the majority of his work the rest of his career. He first worked on DC's comics revival of the Justice Society and All-Star Comics and later Adventure Comics, including this very comic we talked about today, DC Special 29, and famously, less than a year later, the death of the Earth 2 Batman. Staton also illustrated the solo adventures of the two female JSA members created during this revival. First, Power Girl and Showcase, and then he also co-created Huntress, as we talked about before, with Paul Levitz, and drew her adventures first in Batman Family and later in Wonder Woman. During this time, he additionally drew the Legion of Superheroes and the 1970s revival of the Doom Patrol in Showcase and the Metalmen. And in 1979, he began a 2.5-year run on Green Lantern, during which he co-created network favorites The Omega Men with writer Marv Wolfman. He was pretty busy in the 70s and 80s.
You know what's not mentioned here is Showcase 100, which is one of the greatest comics written and drawn in the 1970s. It's like Crisis on Infinite Earths 10 years before Crisis or whenever it was.
Great comic.
Freaking love that comic. And Joe Staton drew the heck out of it.
He sure did. Staton did leave DC briefly and moved on to First Comics in 1981 and served as art director there for 3 years. He encouraged new artists such as Tim Truman and Rick Burchett and drew a new series of E-Man and Mike Mauser, as well as a classics illustrated version of A Christmas Carol, which I still have. I used to read that one to my kids when they were younger.
Oh, that's awesome. That's fantastic.
He returned to DC Comics for a second run on Green Lantern, first with Mike W. Barr, and then primarily with Steve Englehart. During this run, he co-created many Green Lanterns, including Kilowog, Arisia, Shag's favorite, and Salak, and saw the title's name change to Green Lantern Corps. Probably most notably, though, he designed Guy Gardner's new bad boy look and helped redefine him into the character we know today.
I know a little bit about Guy Gardner.
You've heard about him before, yeah, haven't you?
Just a little bit.
Staton and Englehart also created the DC Weekly crossover series Millennium in 1988, but the less we say about that, the better. In the early 1990s, he provided the artwork for Mike Danger's Sunday comic strip, written by Max Allen Collins, another network favorite. From the late 90s into the 2000s, he drew Scooby-Doo for DC for younger readers. Joe contributed over 100 issues over 10 years of Scooby-Doo. It's possible that Joe has drawn more Scooby-Doo comics than anyone else. Another quote from Joe. It
says, I really enjoyed the challenge of Scooby. The Scooby crew travels the world, and I try to get the settings as close as I can, relying on a huge stack of old National Geographics and tracking down curious sites on the web. I don't want some little kid to have his or her faith in Scooby shattered by running across conflicting information on the Discovery Channel. This guy's amazing. He is so amazing. I love this guy more every minute.
In 1998, he received an Eisner Award for World's Finest, the Superman Batman Adventures in the Animated Style. That was the issue that adapted the three-part storyline where Superman and Batman first met on the Animated Universe. And he won an Inkpot Award for that as well from the San Diego Comic-Con. In 2011, Tribune Media Services announced that Staton and Mike Curtis would replace Dick Locker as the creative team for Dick Tracy comic strip. For 10 years, Joe drew the daily and Sunday Dick Tracy newspaper strip, winning 3 Harvey Awards for Best Syndicated Strip. Jove retired after drawing Dick Tracy for 10 years, and he now does commissions and limited projects as well as attending conventions worldwide. I did want us to read an excerpt from Joe's website from last year. Joe was invited to the premiere of Superman due to his creation of Guy Gardner, of course, and he wrote about it on his website in his own words, which I did edit for brevity.
It's been a little over a month since Hillary and I were in Hollywood for the world premiere of Superman featuring Guy Gardner, and I have a few comments. We enjoyed the Superman movie quite a bit. Of course, we were especially happy to see Guy Gardner, the Green Lantern who had been remade by Steve Englehart and me. Guy's standout bowl haircut was still in place, and we were pleased to see that Steve and I were credited at the end of the movie. A couple of personal notes about after the movie. Hollywood Boulevard had been closed off for the red carpet, which was reserved for people invited to the premiere. There was a long metal barrier lined with curious people on the other side. Hillary and I left the theater and were walking down the carpet when I heard, "Hey, Joe!" I didn't expect that, but we stopped and looked, checking out the crowd on the other side of the barrier. I waved at the guy I'm pretty sure I recognized. I knew him from conventions. I shouldn't have been so surprised, after all. Cons and movies overlap, especially at Superman. But I was surprised and pleased to be recognized.
I love that. I love that a fan was there and gave him some props. That was fantastic.
That is so awesome. That is so awesome. By the way, I was just in Hollywood. I was just right where they're talking about. So this is, I can picture all of this at the red carpet. I was there when they were doing the Oscars. All right. Joe continues. Further down the street, we had our passes taken and we went into the big ballroom area behind El Capitan Theater. We made our way in, getting our bearings and seeing if we could place anyone. We located actor Nathan Fillion, who played Guy Gardner so well. When I told him that I had designed Guy's haircut, he responded, "So you're the one," and laughed. There's a bunch of photos on the site of Joe with Nathan and others. We spent time with DC writers and artists like Steve Englehart, Marv Wolfman, Dan Jurgens, and Tom King. We had a nice conversation with James Gunn. Around then, a DC photographer appears and takes shots of the GL group, Green Lantern group, and Nathan Fillion joined us. He looked around and looked at me and commented, "Didn't I just get a photo with you?" "Sure did," I responded and added, "Now we must be old pals." So it was a fun night and we were pleased with the movie and to be invited. Maybe next time we'll walk the red carpet for the Guy Gardner spinoff. I'm so glad you pulled this quote. This is fantastic. I actually got teary-eyed the first time I read it. It just, the idea of Joe getting to go to the premiere, being recognized by fans, getting to spend time with Nathan Fillion, talking to James Gunn, all this.
Makes you feel good, doesn't it?
Right. These creators don't get enough credit. They work their butts off for not a lot. Once in a while, once in a blue moon, they get recognized, and it's really lovely when it happens.
Yeah, no, I agree. I love it. I'd love to see them get these perks now. James Gunn is really good at that. He's kind of one of us in that regard, which I definitely appreciate. To wrap up, Mike's Amazing World has 654 story credits for Joe Staten.
Oh my god.
11,000 pages, just a giant in the industry. You can meet him in a bunch of shows. I have seen him, I don't know, several times at Baltimore Comic Con, and he never has much of a line. I always just go up to him and say thank you and shake his hand. You know, I've had stuff signed from him, but I don't do that anymore. I just go up and tell him thank you.
He's a fantastic guy. He's so nice. I got to chat with him a couple years back. Commissioned a head sketch of Power Girl from Joe Staten, and it's amazing, and I love it. Absolutely the sweetest man. He's so nice. And his wife is super nice as well, by the way.
Absolutely. So just to end on a quote from this book again from Kupperberg, Staten says, "We were the generation who got into comics on purpose, and I was very pleased to be there. As you know, we couldn't have been there when comic books were being invented, but at least we got to be there when they were being reinvented." So I just thought that was a great little quote to end.
Very nice summation.
We have one last special feature. In this comic, there is a terrific two-page text feature, and it's called The Story Behind the Story. And it's sort of supposed to be, why did this comic come about? But it's really more a history of the Justice Society and all their appearances. And we'll touch on a few things. But Shaq, give me your impressions of this feature, The Story Behind the Story.
Well, it's funny. If you look at it two different ways. If you look at it from the lens of 1977, this is amazing.
Right.
First of all, it's a fun little story about how they're doing all this research. But what a tool to learn the history of every character. Now, if you look at it through a modern day lens, that's the other lens. You're like, I can get all this off Wikipedia. But back then, this was invaluable. I told you earlier, I was all about lists, right? I have several pages, which I found not too long ago, of JSA history, where I go issue by issue of the original All-Star Comics saying, okay, this character left, this character stayed, this character left. And I thought I had pulled it all from America versus the Justice Society, but I'm willing to bet I pulled it from America versus the Justice Society and this, because this is an incredible resource to learn to know when the characters were coming and going in the JSA back in the Golden Age.
I ate this up when I was a kid. I loved this stuff. I would read this and read it again. There's lots of little tidbits. Like, for example, Mr. Terrific only appeared in one Golden Age story. He's lucky he made it back in the 70s revival.
Yeah.
You know, just stuff like that. It's not credited, but I'm pretty sure Paul Levitz wrote this, right?
Well, the way it's written, it almost has to be, because he talks in first person about the person who wrote this comic.
Yeah, he does talk some about the fact that the adventures started and they're already a team. And that was right after November 1940 when this story is set. So it was a good fit for the time. And I just love this stuff. There's not mentions of things that are more sophisticated that come later. Like, for example, the almost breakup of All American Comics and DC Comics, that you have to read sort of modern stories. Like, I have the whole set of History of American Comic Books by Tomorrow's, which are fantastic. I've read them all, like 10 volumes cover to cover. They're really great. And you get a lot more of that kind of stuff there. So that's a little much for this kind of feature. But, you know, again, when I was a kid, I ate that up. This and 100-page Super Spectaculars is how I learned about the history of DC Comics, which is, you know, I love so much.
I love these text pieces in the back. And this one also, by the way, for those of you who still get mad that Crisis happened because of a letter, this incredible story of the JSA came from a letter also. Some kid wrote in and said, well, I want to see the first, you know, the origin of the JSA. So that's why they wrote this.
Yep.
So it's a lot of fun. I mean, these text pieces, jumping forward for me, more timely for me at least, was like the Aquaman miniseries had some amazing text pieces by Mark Waid talking about the history of Aquaman and talking about Ramona Freyden. And that's how I learned my history. Yeah, they're fantastic.
And we should mention, there is a terrific key to the splash page at the top right corner. And we'll include a scan of this in the gallery. But there's a key with outlines of each of the heroes. There are 23 characters on the very first page. And there's a key to who they all are for all those kids who are like, who is that guy? and they can go back and refer to it here, which I love. I think that's fantastic.
Yeah. Learning who Mr. Terrific was is probably like a big deal at this point, because who could remember him? I mean, he barely even been around. Sadly, the story behind the story is not included in the DC Infinite app. So if you want to read the story behind the story, you're going to check out the image gallery that Paul's going to share, or pick out your comic.
Yep. I will make one last comment. My personal copy, the little tab, and I have a few comics like this at the bottom of the second page with the Great Superman Movie Contest. And this was the letter A. You had to collect all the letters to spell out the word Superman. Mine was cut out. Okay. But I didn't end up having all the letters, I think, and I taped it back in. So my copy has the Superman Movie Contest strip that you're supposed to cut out taped back in to the comic book.
And that's why Paul wasn't in the Superman movie, folks.
That's why I wasn't in the Superman movie. That's right.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, I love it. This is great. My copy's beat up, but it's precious to me. Like I said, brag one last time, the fact that I got it signed by Joe Staton and Paul Levitz, my personal friends. You know, it's just, this was clearly the one I bought when I was a kid, and I just love having it on my spinner rack. I can look at it anytime I want. It's great. So, Shag, I think I know your answer, but I ask everybody this. Did this comic live up to its special billing?
Well, I don't know. I've just spent the last hour saying really nice things about it. It kind of sucked, really. No, this thing's amazing. This comic is such a wonderful celebration of the JSA. It's got such an incredible legacy. The artwork's amazing. Paul Levitz had a great time writing it. It's absolutely special billing.
Couldn't agree more. It's got great cover. Like I said, three fantastic splash pages, a special occasion of it being the origin and first sort of team up of all these heroes and the story behind the story. All that stuff makes it just a great package and something that I have been wanting to cover on this for a while, but I wanted to wait until it was really the right time to do it. So that's why we did this
time. I'll tell you something that I haven't told many people, but I'll say it, what the heck. And everyone stop listening by this point anyway, I'm sure. You know, I'm doing JSA in the 90s. You may have heard about it. I don't know. I haven't invited you to be on the show because you're annoying. But JSA in the 90s, in a little less than a year, is going to become JSA in the 2000s. If I live long enough, okay, because there's a lot to cover in the JSA 2000s, I've often thought about then doing JSA in the 70s. And a lot of it has to do with this comic and the All-Star Comics revival. Those are the two things that I would love to dive into. Who knows? Maybe in another 15 years from my walker, I will podcast about...
We're just do Who's Who in the JSA, right?
We're going to keep that show going.
A new way to do Who's Who. Just make it all about the JSA. Thanks again for joining me, Shag. In case anybody's, you know, never heard you on the network before or is not familiar with your litany of shows, could you remind them how, the things you're working on and how they could get in touch with you?
Sure. And Paul's going to go grab a soda. Go, well, this is going to take a while. You can find me on the Firewater Podcast Network on shows such as JSA in the 90s, which is part of the Justice Society Presents podcast feed. There, I'm covering the exploits of the JSA and its team members as they were published in the 1990s. And again, we'll be moving into JSA in the 2000s soon. I have another podcast called Marvel Star Wars From Empire to Jedi, where we're covering the Marvel Star Wars comics that were released in between Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi, my personal sweet spot for Star Wars comics. I absolutely love those. Then I've got another show called Once Upon a Geek, which is my variety podcast where I can talk about any topic that I want to. Sometimes it's Blue Devil, sometimes it's Doctor Who, sometimes it's X-Men or What If, or the 1980s series V, Star Trek novels, other books, anything I want to talk about. Then quarterly, I appear on the FW Team Up podcast, which is Siskoid's show. I'm a guest there quarterly, covering the Marvel Team Up stories with Spider-Man. Right now, we're digging into the Chris Claremont and John Byrne stories, which are so much fun. And then also quarterly, you can find me on Who's Who Review, which is the podcast that, quite frankly, built this network. We have covered the entire Who's Who series, and now we're going back through that classic series in a randomized fashion 4 times a year, and we're having a blast with it. And by the time you hear this, if you go back to our most recent episode, you can hear a very special interview with Mr. Chuck Patton, one of the artists of Who's Who himself. It's an awesome conversation. And if you want to find me on social media, I'm out there. Most of those podcasts have their own handles, but I'm most active on Once Upon a Geek.
Excellent. Well, thanks again, Jag. I really appreciate it. I'm going to play a quick promo. And when I return, you'll hear the Monthly Planet segment with Sean M. Myers and my next episode announcement and listener feedback. So stay tuned.
It's the year 1992, and the Justice Society of America, the world's first superhero team, make a triumphant return after 6 years trapped in another dimension. Finally home, the JSA find themselves relics in a world that has moved on. It's the age of pulse-pounding action, where the rules of fair play are tossed aside for gritty violence. Our heroes ask themselves, does the world still need a Justice Society? Oh, yes, it does. Join me, the Irredeemable Shag, for JSA in the 90s. We'll delve into the 10-issue Justice Society of America ongoing series, drawn by the iconic Mike Parabek. We'll explore the 8-issue retroactive miniseries and unearth hidden gems from the era. Join us for JSA in the 90s, available as part of the Justice Society Presents podcast feed.
Welcome back. I am Sean M. Myers, your co-editor-in-chief of the Monthly Planet. In this segment, Paul and I will discuss the beloved series of DC house ads, The Daily Planet, that ran in the back pages of DC Comics from 1976 to 1981. This month, we are discussing the issues from 50 years ago, July 1976.
And as always, we want to acknowledge our favorite website, Mike's Amazing World of Comics. If you go there and click on Galleries, then Daily Planet, you can read all the issues there. Thanks, Mike.
Plus, don't forget to follow our Blue Sky account, The Monthly Planet, for the issues and other fun. Okay, the first one up this month is the week of July 5th, 1976. Superman attacked by young pal. John Ross gains mysterious superpowers. Metropolis. Attacks have come at Superman from many directions, so there are few things left which will surprise him. But the Man of Steel received a terrific shock when his young friend, John Ross, mysteriously gained superpowers and attacked him in midair over the city. According to witnesses Jerry Conway, Kurt Swan, and Bob Oxner, the boy was only one of four people who during the course of the day were endowed with the powers and the overwhelming urge to destroy the Metropolis Marvel. The cause of this is the parasite's prism of peril, which the power-packed villain is using to drain his super foe of his super strength. Unfortunately for the parasite, and Superman as well, the prism is diverting the energy into other people like John Ross. The full story will appear in Superman number 304 on sale the week of July 12th. Don't miss it. What'd you think, Paul?
I like this. I have read this. I enjoyed it. I like the issues when they were bringing Pete Ross back into Superman's life and his adult. And this is Pete's son. Of course, Pete knows Superman's identity. And then the son learns it. The only thing I didn't like, later on, they did some weird stuff where they shipped the kid off to another planet. And Superman agreed to leave him there and cause a rightful anger from his father. I don't think that was a well-written story, but these were good. I like these a lot when he's, a little boy visiting Metropolis. So they're fun.
Obviously, I know who Pete Ross is. And I know he had a son and all that. So Pete Ross knows that Clark Kent is Superboy, Superman.
But Clark doesn't know that Pete knows.
John Ross knows that Superman is Clark Kent, and Clark Kent knows that John knows.
Right.
Does Pete know that John knows, and does John know that Pete knows? Because I think it's no.
I think the answer is no. I think the answer is no. It's always fun to have Superman have a super pal, but the Parasite's Prism of Peril, it's a great title, you know? And I always liked the Parasite.
I love the Parasite. I have no idea why. I know he was on the animated series. I have no idea why they have not brought him into live action. I just, like, visually, he's fantastic looking. However, if you're updating him, don't make him super gross, which is what I kind of think they...
I think they would do that too. Yeah.
Yeah, but I don't want him to be like that.
So I don't think we'll see him for a while because of Clayface, but we'll see.
Yeah.
You know, Clayface is going to be like a horror movie, right? So I think, you know, Parasite, while his powers are very different, I think his visual appearance, I think it translates to movies probably better in the sort of gray that Parasite will be than the purple. And purple might be. But if anybody can do it, James Gunn can do it.
Yeah. And this story is great because the power is split between the people and it turns them like bad. It brings out their rage issues. Yeah, it's a great story. Okay, so the second one is Isis premieres in her own book. Direct from her guest appearance in Shazam number 25, which we talked about last month, comes Isis in her own magazine. Handling the adventures of the queen of Saturday morning television are Denny O'Neill, Rick Estrada, and Wally Wood, who serve up a battle between Isis and Scarab, the man who would destroy. If you've been a fan of the Shazam Isis Hour on CBS TV, you won't want to miss a single issue of this great new magazine. Number one will be on sale the week of July 12th. Get there early or you might miss it.
We talked about this last month. I don't have a strong connection to Isis. You got Rick Estrada, who's kind of more of a journeyman guy, but you know, you got Wally Wood doing the inks, and he was famous for drawing beautiful women. So I think that's why they put him on that book.
Yeah, I've only been able to find one issue of Isis. I mean, certainly I could go on eBay. I'd like to read them. Yeah, I hope they would turn up in a finest, but I don't know. I don't know if there are rights issues with that, with Filmation.
There might be, because she showed up on TV first, right? And I don't think these have ever been reprinted.
But... yeah, I don't think so either. The next story is Hawkman battles Swamp Thing in Portland. Reports come in that Swamp Thing has been sighted in Portland, Oregon, and Carter Hawkman Hall is off to investigate. And before the creature of the Merc can explain himself, he's in the middle of a battle royal, or royale, with the Winged Wonder. What will be the outcome? Ask David Kraft, Ernie Chua, and Fred Carrillo. They'll tell you to check out the answers in The Sky Above in Swamp Thing number 25 on sale the week of July 5th.
So I had the Bronze Age Swamp Thing omnibus, which had a lot of these stories in it. It had the original Bernie Wrightson, Len Wein stories, and it had the Marty Pasca stories, and then it had the pre-Alan Moore stories when they brought it back. And they're all pretty good. They're pretty entertaining. But I do not recall what the heck Swamp Thing was doing in Portland, Oregon. You know, and that's not his usual haunt.
I think he was checking out the homebrew circuit.
I guess.
I don't know that this one will be included. I know somewhere down the line there is a Swamp Thing DC Finest. I guess it's probably coming out next year. And I don't know if it gets this far. I can't say I've never read Swamp Thing. I read the first couple issues. I guess it's the Saga of the Swamp Thing. That was the one that was like...
that's Marty Pasca, right. That, yeah. And that went 18 issues before Alan Moore came on. And that was written, I think, almost, if not all of them, most of them by Marty Pasca, yeah.
I'm super late. I think the only Alan Moore issue I read is Anatomy Lesson, and that's because it was reprinted in the Digest. And I love the Digest, but even I can understand why the Digest is not a good format for that story.
Agreed.
And in fact, I think some pages were like flipped or swapped or something like that.
Oh, really?
And the thing is, I know it's a good story, so I know I'll enjoy it when I read it. So I'm looking forward to it. Okay, now we're going to go to Lola Barnett's Comics World, Dateline DC. These are all written as rumor and like that kind of thing. So what popular TV classroom will soon be appearing in a DC comic of its own? Sweat hogs everywhere will love it. And if you don't know, we'll get to it at the end of the episode. Looks like Robin, Kid Flash, Speedy, and Wonder Girl will be back together again in their own magazine, Teen Titans, of course.
Woo-hoo!
Lightning strikes twice, but we predict Black Lightning will be a hit with its first issue on sale soon. The Justice League had better watch out. Informed sources tell me the Joker is out to get them, and he won't quit until they're all dead.
Deshaun.
Wow.
What issue is she talking about there?
Isn't that like the Earth 2 team up?
Nope.
Not the Earth 2, the JSA. Isn't he in that? Isn't he in
Yeah, that's not it.
Oh.
That is an ad for the Joker number 10, which never came out.
Oh.
has, which I read last night, and it is pretty bonkers. And ends on a cliffhanger. He apparently has killed like five Justice Leaguers, and it ends on a cliffhanger.
I'm not putting you on the spot. Do you know who wrote that? And the only reason I ask is because a lot of times writers who have written continued stories that were cut off, if you go on their social media, that they might tell you what they're going to do, or they'll...
Elliot Magan, I think, was the main writer of it. And he, okay. I just checked, he wrote number 9. I don't recall. I should. I just read it last night.
Oops. Sorry, guys. The writer of Joker number 10 was Marty Pasco.
And they do have that in the Joker Finest. They reprinted it 2 other times. I had another slim trade paperback of just those 10 issues at one point. I upgraded to the Finest. And then it was also in the Joker Omnibus that they had come out. So it's been reprinted a couple of times. Or not reprinted. It was published a few times, even though it never actually came out. I hadn't read it in forever. And I was surprised last night when I was rereading it to realize that it ends on a cliffhanger.
Planeteers, we're recording this super, super early. And just a few days ago on Blue Sky, I think, is it Paul Kupferberg who did Secret Society of Supervillains?
Well, Bob did it, Jerry Conway did it, and there's at least one other writer.
Whoever wrote the last published issue, it ends on a cliffhanger, but I think they did say like how it was going to end. Okay, getting back to Lola. And it looks like Batman and Wonder Woman will be crossing paths in an upcoming Brave and the Bold. That's it for now, Lola. Now we're going to go to Direct Currents. On sale the week of July 27th. Brave and the Bold number 130. And that's Batman and the Atom and Green Arrow facing off against the Joker and Two-Face.
Batman and 4 famous co-stars.
Yeah. And that's Death at Rainbow's End. Hey, Max. Plastic Man number 15. Meet the Snuffer, a paid assassin who's a robot and is out to steal Plastic Man's powers. Steve Skeets, Ramona Fraiden, and Robert Smith will have you stretched out with laughter when you read this one. Hercules Unbound, number 7. Cobra, number 5. We talked about Cobra.
Yep.
DC Special, number 24, The Three Musketeers, plus Robin Hood versus the Merry Men, and the Viking Prince meets the Viking Genie.
Yep. So I covered number 25, the issue after this, a few months ago on DC Special Cast with my pal, David Steele.
Okay, trivia quiz number 10.
All right, I'm ready.
Many of our superheroes have magazines of their own, while others star in comics, which have other name, but I think it's supposed to be names. Do you know who stars in Our Army at War, World's Finest Comics, Adventure Comics, G.I. Combat, and All-Star Comics?
All right, I'm ready.
I'll tell you right now, I would maybe know 3 of them, if that. Okay, Our Army at War.
So this was before they retitled Our Army at War to Sergeant Rock. So that's Sergeant Rock. That title became Sergeant Rock. So that I didn't know.
I did not know that. World's Finest Comics.
That's easy. Superman and Batman. Now, whether they are asking for backup features and such.
No, that's it. Man, good luck. Adventure Comics.
Adventure Comics at this time could be just about anything, but I think last month we talked about Aquaman being in it, so that's the only reason I would. I mean, Aquaman's been in it like 3 different times, so I guess that's a good guess anyway.
Yeah, so honestly, I would have known it because we just talked about it. If we wouldn't have talked about that, and I guess I know the dollar comics weren't around there, so I probably would have said Supergirl or Aquaman. I guess those two probably had like a...
Well, Supergirl and the Legion both had really... Well, the Legion had a really long run, and then Supergirl. Then it started rotating a lot more, and Superboy came back. And
much later, of course, Dial H for Hero, Plastic Man, Starman, Aquaman again. Okay, and then G.I. Combat.
So I think that's the Haunted Tank.
Yes. And I would not have known that.
Losers are in something else. Like Star Spangled War Stories, I think. I don't know. I get the war comics all mixed up.
Yeah. And then finally, All-Star Comics.
That is the Justice Society of America.
I would have known that, although they are trying to make the Super Squad happen.
Yes, and it did. All right, moving on to the week of July 12th, 1976. Issue number 11, volume 76. Green Lantern duels Sinestro in space. The Emerald Crusader rescues a fellow ring slinger. While on a routine patrol through his assigned space sector, Hal Jordan, the Green Lantern of Earth, has come across his arch foe Sinestro, the renegade former member of the Green Lantern Corps. While engaged in battle, Sinestro reveals to the Emerald Crusader that he has already defeated another of the ring slinging corps, a Green Lantern who lies dying on a small asteroid nearby. What choice can our Green Lantern make but to save his fellow Lantern and allow the evil Sinestro to go free? But despite his good intentions, Green Lantern will have to live to regret that choice. Sinestro has a plot hatching, which will involve not only the Emerald Crusader, but his pal Green Arrow as well. Denny O'Neill and Mike Grell will tell you all about The Revenge of the Renegade and Green Lantern number 91 on sale the week of July 19th. So this is really interesting because you barely hear about Green Arrow. He's on the cover. He was co-starring because this is the time when it was Green Lantern and Green Arrow. But this one, obviously set in space, it's much more of a space opera. Great run. I love these stories. You know, good stuff. So did you have any of these when you were a kid, Sean?
I know I had a couple of Green Lantern, Green Arrow books. Mm-hmm. This would have been like when I first started reading. Right. So in my mind, they were like always together.
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, I would have known Green Lantern from the Justice League because when I first started reading, he didn't have his title. And then he had backups in The Flash. I was reading The Flash. And then they brought this back. And I was very excited because I really enjoyed this title. It came out. They did come out with the Bronze Age Green Lantern, Green Arrow omnibus like a year or so ago. And I did read that at that time and really enjoyed rereading all those stories. They're great.
For everyone listening who's taking bets on what Sean's pick is going to be for like his favorite story, I can tell you the tie is going to be between this story and next story for the bottom two rungs. When we do The Planet, we normally record like Saturday or Sunday. So starting like that Monday or Tuesday, I will read the four main stories. So I would have read this 2 or 3 days ago. I remember nothing. I remember the art being really good. I do remember that. And I kind of remember that other Green Lantern that like Sinestro gets. And man, that is it. This is written by Denny O'Neill, right? It's like, yeah. I like him. I think he's good. The art's good.
Denny O'Neill has like a 70% great story hit rate, but the other 30% is really, we saw that even on Batman Family, right? Didn't he write that one of the, with the kangaroo race? Remember?
Oh, man. Oh. Oh, geez.
Anyway, good odds you're going to get a pretty good story, Denny O'Neill, but not 100%. The next one is Warlord battles the Lizard Men at the center of the Earth. The Warlord is back in Skitaris. He's still trailing the evil Deimos, who has captured his beautiful woman, Tara. The Warlord travels across the lands inside the Earth, seeking both revenge and the freedom of the people of Skitaris. So this is all by Mike Grell. And at the time when Mike Grell was still inking it before Vince Coletta got a hold of it, a couple notes I looked up because this issue came out 8 months after the previous issue. Why, might you say? The first two issues came out in October of 75 and December of 75. And then this issue came out in July of 76. It was early in 76 that Jeanette Kahn came up. Julie Schwartz had canceled Warlord. He didn't think much of it. He had canceled it. Jeanette Kahn came on board and said, hey, where's the Warlord on the schedule? I love that. That was really good. And she uncanceled it. And then, of course, it became very, very, very popular. So that's why there was such a long break between issues 2 and 3.
And they wouldn't have had the sales figure. Like, after 2 months, no, he wouldn't have had the sales.
Yeah, he just didn't like it. He just didn't like it. Right, exactly. Yeah, pretty funny. The next one, though, Superstars of Space Roam the Galaxy. Adam Strange travels 25 trillion miles to battle the Siren of Space. The three star rovers ask the question, who saved the Earth? And Space Ranger relives his very first case in the Great Plutonium Plot in DC Superstars of Space, number 8. I've got a couple people who raised their hands now for DC Superstars of Space. There are 4 different issues of it. Hopefully, I'll get those on later this year.
I know we're not there yet, but I can tell you right now, I hope that Star Rovers never, ever come up in the trivia thing, because I don't know anything about them. Maybe after I listen to your episode, that will come up in the future. Maybe I'll know more about them, but I don't even know. Did they have a Who's Who page? I don't even remember that. My guess is no.
All right, Direct Currents on sale week of July 19th, Superboy 220. Superboy and his Legionnaires must become super soldiers of the Slave Maker. Jim Cuter and Mike Grell, who's very busy this time of year. Kung Fu Fighter number 12. Interesting. It doesn't say Rich or Dragon Kung Fu Fighter. Yeah. It's off to Red China. Not just regular China, but Red China for our martial arts master and his friends in A Dragon Defiant by David Kraft, Rick Estrada, and Jack Abel. World's Finest 241. Bruce Wayne and Clark Kent are on board the last spaceship from Earth as it takes off for a new and better world. Another Bob Haney classic. And then House of Mystery 246. You've got stories by Mike Fleischer, Jack Olick, and a bunch of other fun stuff. Ragman number 2. More of the saga of this new kind of superhero in The Tattered Tatterdemalion by Bob Kaniger, Joe Kubert, and the Renondo Studio. So we talked about the first issue of Ragman 2 months ago, because this is a bi-monthly. And again, only 5 issues, but some neat stuff. All right, Secret Identity time again in the trivia, Sean. You ready?
Yes.
This time in reverse. Now you're getting their civilian names. Who are the superheroes named? 1, Ray Palmer. 2, Happy Terrell. 3, Charles McNider. Donna Troy. And Tinya Wazo. All right, number 1, Ray Palmer.
That's the Atom.
Happy Terrell?
Oh, God.
Come on, you know this. He's very bright.
Oh, Firebrand?
No. Fights for Freedom.
The Ray?
The Ray. Very good.
Okay.
Charles McNider.
That's Dr. Midnight, right?
Mm-hmm. Donna Troy.
Wonder Girl.
And Tinya Wazo.
So I know it's Legion. Is that Shrinking Violet?
No.
Oh, man, I'm not doing well on these Legion. Last time the Legion. I know it's a.
It is a Legion.
Woman, yes. Female. So it's not Shrinking Violet. It
controversial. Who's who? Paige.
Phantom Girl?
Phantom Girl. There you go.
Okay.
I remember those two guys arguing whether it was attractive or not, because I think it was by Jamie Hernandez.
Yeah. Okay. Daily Planet, issue 12, volume 76, week of July 18th, 1976. Batman and Black Spider battle to the death.
Bum, bum, bum.
Gotham City. The Batman, foe of every type of crime that pervades Gotham City, has competition in the shape of the Black Spider. Sworn to stop the drug traffic in the Big Apple, Black Spider is not going to let anyone stop him, including Batman. So when their paths cross, it sets up a battle to the death between the two heroes, and only one will survive. What will be the result of this life and death struggle aboard the Doomsday Express? Jerry Conway, Ernie Chua, and Frank McLaughlin know the answers in Detective Comics number 464, on sale the week of July 26th. And also in Tech 464. The Calculator is back, and this time he's out after the Black Canary, flying solo for the first time in this magazine. What is the Computer of Crime's plan? Well, when the temperature in Star City soars to over 200 degrees, you can bet there'll be a hot time in Star City tonight. It's a Bob Rozakis, Mike Grell, Terry Austin thriller.
I know that was your favorite chapter.
That was my favorite chapter.
Yeah, we talked about this one not that long ago. The first story with the Black Spider, you know, I think Jerry Conway was trying to come up with a Punisher-like character, and, you know, because he had come up with the Punisher over at Marvel. Didn't really stick, but the stories were fun. I did enjoy, read those when we were doing the Calculator, so they are fun.
I think the story is interesting. I like that Batman talks to a prostitute. I like that.
Yeah.
I think the villain's motivation is very, very interesting. I think the costume is very, very blah.
Yeah.
So it almost looks like a Supreme Court justice robe, like Ruth Bader Ginsburg with like the white thing like on top. So
very frilly. It's supposed to be a web, but it's looks frilly.
Yeah. So I read this one after Green Arrow, Green Lantern comic. And I think I remember a little bit more about that, but not lots.
But the Calculator story is embedded in your brain forever. Rent free. Black Canary at 500 degrees, you know?
I agree with that. Okay, the next story we're going to read is Haunted Tank Faces Dinosaurs, World War II. They've had lots of weird and wild battles before, but the crew of the Haunted Tank has never come up against anything quite like the war that time forgot. Jeb Stuart and his men come nose to nose with a Triceratops, trade blows with a Pterodactyl, and end up on a collision course with a Tyrannosaurus in the strangest battle of all. Bob Kaniger and Sam Glanzman have pulled out all the stops on this one. A war story like none you've ever read before. Also in GI Combat number 195, on sale the week of July 16th, A New Adventures of the OSS Champagne for a Butcher by Bart Reagan and Rick Estrada.
Who doesn't want to see tanks versus dinosaurs? That's all I have to say.
This dinosaur has like a tank in its mouth and a tank in its little mini hand.
I know.
Wonder Woman battles God of Fire. Wonder Woman, filled with the powers of the gods, has met many of them during her long career. But in A Life in Flames, in Wonder Woman number 226, she comes face to face with a new one, Hephaestus, the god of fire. Hephaestus has struck a bargain with Ares, the god of war, and the amazing Amazon has become a pawn in a deadly game. Just what is the plan of Ares and Hephaestus? Marty Pasco, Jose Delbo, and Vince Coletta will show you when WW number 226 goes on sale the week of July 26th.
I like this era of Wonder Woman. They are not universally good, but there are some good stories in there. The problem was they really didn't know what to do with her. Steve Trevor died twice and came back twice, and then she's works for the UN. Then she becomes an astronaut for some reason. Then she does something. Yeah. So it's just, they really had a trouble with her, but these are fun. Again, not the best comics of all, but fun reads.
I know it kind of doesn't make sense because obviously, like, I love superheroes, the Greek and Roman gods. I just.
Not your thing, huh?
Not at all. Like, I love New Teen Titans. And there's, I guess when just Wonder Girl meets like the old type man, I don't know if it's just because
You were resenting when you had to learn about them in grade school, probably.
Well, not grade school. It was in high school. It was junior high, and like we had the list all of them, and maybe I passed, but it doesn't make, because like I like superpowers and stuff like that, so it makes sense that I should like it. But for whatever reason, it just has
Not your thing. It's all
never
right.
gone with
That's
me.
all right.
The Direct Currents on sale next week of July 26th. The Witching Hour number 66, which has A Scream in the Attic, The Night Visitor, and Half a Killer is Better Than None. Action Comics number 464. Batman and the Flash have been turned into kids again, and the man behind it promises, Superman, I'm going to rerun your life in the story by Kerry Bates, plus Kurt Swan and Tex Blaisdell. Plus, a visiting dignitary gets to see Metropolis with Clark Kent by E. Nelson Bridwell and Kurt Schaffenberger. Tarzan number 254 has Vengeance and Mercy. Super Team Family number 7. The Teen Titans learn that to order is to destroy by Steve Skeets, George Tuska, and Nick Carty. And the Doom Patrol square off against the Brotherhood of Evil. Now, I know you talked about whether Super Team Family should be in DC Special, and I'm saying no.
Oh, you're a
no offense
Nova.
to, no,
Interesting.
because it's like a different. Plus, also, it was like Super Team Family. If anything, if you're going to do Batman Family Reunion and Superman Family Ties and Tarzan Family and Super Team Family, I would lump it in with that versus the DC Specials. Like, DC Special obviously had whatever, like, the four, I don't know, the four. DC Special, DC Special Stars, DC, like that kind of. But I'm voting no, just because it should be like its own.
All right,
It's
fair enough. So later this year, I'm going to be giving some thought to all the structure of all this stuff, what's included, if we're going to expand DC Special Cast at all. There have been calls to make the Monthly Planet its own show. We'll see, all that kind of stuff. So we'll work all that out at the second half of the year.
okay, time for trivia. Trivia quiz number 12. Lots of superheroes have pets, and lots of other animals have had prominent roles in our books. Can you identify the following animal stars? And like I always do, I'll read them all first and then go back. Superman's super dog, Congo Bill's alter ego, Supergirl's super horse, Batman's bat hound, Angel's partner. So who is Superman's super dog?
Yeah, that's Crypto, of course.
Yes. Congo Bill's alter ego.
So that's Kongorilla, Triss's magic ring.
Supergirl's super horse.
So I'm pretty sure his name was Comet, right?
Yes.
Because the cat was Streaky and the horse is Comet. But he was like
Correct.
really a person too. I don't,
Yeah, I
some
know.
wacky stuff. That's kind of weird.
Batman's bat hound.
We know Ace. We read his first appearance.
Yay. And now this threw me because, like, Angel's partner, the ape, but you have to give his name.
I want to say Abe Simeon, but or something, but I can't remember his first name. But Simeon, like
Correct.
Simeon, was his second
Correct.
name.
Correct.
But what's
Now,
his last? Let me look.
wait,
Come
no,
on.
don't look, don't look, don't look.
I just looked.
So I was going to say it's like Spade, like
Yeah.
how the detective Spade. So yeah,
Yeah.
Sam Spade.
Sam Simeon. I knew Simeon was the last name, but I couldn't remember Sam. Oh, well. All right. Our final issue of the month, volume 76, issue 13, the week of July 26th. The big headline is Cotter quits. Will his first issue be the teacher's last? In Brooklyn, New York City, he is a success as a teacher of the sweat hogs and the idol of people all over the country. So why is Cotter quitting? When Gabe Cotter announces to his class that he is leaving James Buchanan High, the sweat hogs are shocked. Can things be so bad for their leader? Epstein, Barbarino, Washington, and Horshack decide to find out. And when they learn the facts, they pitch in and do everything possible to help Cotter and his wife, Julie, make it through their hard times. Will Gabe be gone before the second issue? Or will his students be saying, "Welcome back, Cotter," at the end of the first fabulous issue? Don't miss Cotter Quits by Elliot Maggin, Jack Sparling, and Bob Ochsner in Welcome Back, Cotter number 1. Sean, we haven't really talked much about Welcome Back, Cotter. What's your take on the show and the comic book? Oh, you pulled a treasury out. All right, very good.
So, Welcome Back, Cotter had a treasury.
Which is amazing to me.
If you are of our age, you remember this. But the ABC sitcoms in the 70s, man, they like ruled pop culture, man.
He
Like
did.
Happy Days, Welcome Back, Cotter, Laverne and Shirley, Three's Company. I mean, like they were like powerhouses. It's so funny to think there was a Welcome Back, Cotter comic. Now, if there was the Office comic or like I don't even know like what
The
I
Office.
don't even know like what you would compare it to. So and they're not great stories or anything. And the one thing though I will say, so this isn't really about the Treasury, but the Treasury has a four-page special feature like how they make the TV show. It's very akin to Alex Toth's 10-page thing about how they make the animated Super Friends cartoons. Because it's not just the actors read the script and they practice and they block and then they film. It's only 4 pages, but it really goes into like a lot of detail about how they film the show. Now, that doesn't really have to do with this issue. It's fine. It's fun. I think probably I genuinely could watch Welcome Back, Kotter and laugh. Mm-hmm. But I don't know that I really would laugh at like any of the stories.
I watched it when I was a kid, but it was never I was big Happy Days fan. I mean, I watched it if it was on, but it wasn't like appointment TV for me. And I don't believe I bought any of the comics.
It just comes into my head, and other people definitely, you're going to have to weigh in. In the 80s, there were a ton of comedians who then had either a sitcom or their comedy. So like Seinfeld and Tim Allen and Roseanne and just like a ton of them. Is this a first instance of like a stand-up? Well, no, because I guess Bob Newhart would have had
his show. Yeah, I don't know. So, you're the pop culture guy more than me. I don't know.
I would be interested in like the history of stand-up comics making the transition over to TV. If anybody knows of like a documentary or anything like that, I'd be interested in watching that.
All right, the next one. Mandy flies in the world's last airplane. In the Earth After Disaster.
Spirit Airlines.
Commanding a men boxer located a still operable airplane, but it's the property of the billionaire hog Howard Bigelow. I'm not going to read any more of that. Danny O'Neill, Keith Giffen, and Jack Abel, Commanding number 47. I recently read through, I had those two hardcovers, Commanding by Jack Kirby, and I'll say I suffered through 40 issues. I know somebody listening likes Commanding. I got through them, but amazing ideas. Jack Kirby is the most amazing creator, visually really fun, but his dialogue is pretty terrible. And, you know, some of them were hard to get through. But anyway, Commanding number 47, have not read it. If anybody loves Commanding, let us know. And then the Specters and Spooks haunt Ghost number 50. Ghosts reaches 50 issues, which is pretty cool. To celebrate, editor Murray Boltonoff presents another collection of ghostly tales like The Most Fearful Villain of the Supernatural, The Trapped Phantom, and Home is Where the Grave Is. And a Ghost in the Supernatural page, which we talked about when I did that issue of DC Special Cast with Chris, on sale the week of August 2nd. That was pretty cool. And then we get the next edition of Lola Barnett's Comics World, Dateline DC. Just a few hot news items from the line of superstars. First, and I do mean first, we're going to talk about our next famous first edition coming in September. Took us a long time to bring to you, but Superman number 1 is finally making it into our large format book. So that's pretty cool. It's the Treasury edition of Superman number 1. Somebody once said that gorillas are popular, so it's not surprising to learn that DC will soon be bringing you another edition of Superheroes Battle Super Gorillas. So I looked up the timing of this. This is in between. We did Superheroes versus Super Gorillas with my pal John Staub a few months ago. That's after this. And the one before it was the DC special. And then finally, it looks like there'll be some changes made in Teen Titans. Rumor has it that the Titan Mal will be in for some shocking surprises in his life. Of course, we know that Mal gets a couple different secret identities and then gets left behind again at the discotheque.
Gabriel's Horn.
All right, Direct Currents on sale the week of August 2nd, Our Army at War 298 with Sergeant Rock. Justice League 136 is the third part of the Crisis on Earth S versus Kull, the Beastman. We talked about him last month. Karate Kid number 5, our master of martial arts faces the man who stole tomorrow. And the Flash 245, Who Put the Zing in the Flash by Kerry Bates and Irv Novik. There is a Green Lantern backup. This was the time they still had a few backups of Green Lantern to run in The Flash right after Green Lantern got his own title back. So I think it was 3 or 4 issues after that. And then 4-Star Spectacular number 5 with stories of Superboy, Wonder Woman, Green Arrow, and the Vigilante. All right, trivia quiz. July 1976 to celebrate the bicentennial. We'll concentrate on the stars half of Stars and Stripes by asking you to name at least 5 DC superstars who have stars on their costumes. All right, Sean.
Okay, I'm kind of writing down some right off the top of my head. Wonder Woman.
Yep.
Star Spangled Kid.
Yep.
Starboy.
Yep.
From Legion. Starboy from Legion.
Yep, I know.
I guess Starman wasn't
nope,
around.
Not a thing yet. Yep. Although the old Starman had a star in his chest. I will accept it, even though it's not here. So that I will accept it.
Okay, and that's really good because I wasn't even thinking of him. So thank you.
Yeah. Cosmic Rod Starman.
Yeah, gosh. Wait, is this heroes or could it be villains too? It's just superstars.
It's superstars, okay. So I would assume heroes.
Oh, well, I guess, yeah, okay.
I will say a relative of one of the ones you already mentioned.
Oh, Stripesy, no.
No.
Oh, Wonder Girl, yeah.
There you go, Wonder Girl.
Okay.
The one that they have that you didn't mention was Uncle Sam.
Does he have stars?
I think on his pants, right? Or...
Oh, my guess, his top hat has stripes, but then they stop. So maybe like...
Oh, yeah. No, it's on his top hat. So I just looked it up. Uncle Sam's top hat has stripes on the top and stars around the base.
Okay.
Yeah, so he does have stars. All right, very good. You got it. That's pretty good. All right, that wraps up our individual discussion. So we'll do a quick run through. Tell me, the photo award, which is the best art of these four issues of the Daily Planet?
Oh, 10,000%. I believe in individual choice and all of that. But if anybody doesn't answer this, you are 10,000% wrong, because it's GI Combat number 195. A dinosaur eating a tank.
That's favorite. Okay, favorite versus best. My vote for best was either Warlord or Green Lantern, both Mike Grell's. But yeah, I mean, that's the most eye-catching one that's going to separate you from your 35 cents. The best debut or number one. We have two of them this issue. We have Isis and we have Welcome Back Cotter. But a debut, I think, The War That Time Forgot, I think that was the first time that they went back. So I would count that as a debut if you wanted to go there.
Yeah, I would go with that or Cotter.
And so would I. I didn't read Welcome Back Cotter and Isis not much, so I would probably go with the dinosaurs. So best comic that you've read out of this month.
So this is unfair because it absolutely is Superman 304 with Parasite. But I can't remember the Green Lantern story. I don't think the detective story was good. And the Welcome Back Cotter story kind of, not that it doesn't count. However, that said, even 304, I think Superman 304 would have held up with any regular normal comic. It's a great story.
The only one I would also argue would be up there for me is Brave and the Bold 130 with the four famous co-stars. You know, I just like that storyline. It's a two-parter. And then one that you haven't read that you want to read now. For me, that's easy.
I think it's the GI Combat.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Although honorable mention to Hercules Unbound, I would like to read that series. But I believe that I may have read this years ago because there was a War That Time Forgot showcase with the black and white reprints. And I bought a bunch of those over the years because you could get them for like $4 or $5 at shows and stuff. And I bought them stuff for my kids to read, you know, at the pool or at the shore or something. You know, some of these odd ones, that's the only time some of these have been reprinted. And I'm pretty sure I have that one. I'd have to go look. And I think I read that story, but I don't really remember it, but I remember enjoying them. And it was a real mix up between like Suicide Squad, which was the old style, you know, before it was the villains, because that was the original War That Time Forgot. But then they brought the Haunted Tank into it, which made it different. So I don't really have a good sense of the history of this. So I would love to read that storyline. I think that's it.
All right. That's it for this segment. Next month, we will, of course, have your reporter feedback. So please leave us some at fireandwaterpodcast.com.
All right. Well, thanks, Sean. So now we have our next episode announcement. In August, we will be venturing into sci-fi with DC Superstars number 16, The Star Hunters. And my guest will be Mike Atchison from Campus Comics Cast and Mike's Comic Shop Roadshow. Yet another genre, so it should be great. And of course, Sean and I will be moving on to August 1976 with The Monthly Planet. Look for it on Sunday, August 2nd. So now in feedback, one came in too late regarding the episode with the Three Musketeers and Robin Hood. It's from John Stibe. He said, I'm sitting at a kid's birthday party that my daughter is attending and realizing I've been remiss in commenting on these episodes. Sorry about that. I never would have bought this comic, but I might own it now, and I love the discussion. I also thoroughly enjoyed the first episode of The Monthly Planet. Great job to everyone involved. Thank you, John. And just so you know, I am recording this feedback a little earlier than I normally do because we have a family vacation. So if your comment doesn't get read right now, rest assured I will get to it next month. So now we'll move on to the comments I've gotten this month about Super DC Giant S24 starring Supergirl with my great guest, Dr. Ange. First up, Rob McCarthy said, you mean the laughing fish with the cat. He said, the best thing about the Joker 9 is the Joker just like Batman and fools Catwoman. Similarly, Nightcaster Ryan Daly said, great episode as always, Paul. It's always a treat to hear Dr. Ange talking anything, but especially Supergirl. I have been reading the current series, which I really like, and was surprised to hear Lena Luthor and Leslie Lahr featured so prominently in this DC special comic. Very cool stuff. I have to say, though, I think my favorite part was learning more about Jim Mooney during your spotlight. Okay, I'm just going to ask the question we've all been thinking about. Why doesn't this network have a podcast dedicated to Stag Magazine? Another fun Monthly Planet installment too, but the very famous Batman story Sean was describing, featuring the Jokerized cat attacking somebody, even mentioning the artist Marshall Rogers, was the Laughing Fish story. Yes, apologies to both Rob and Ryan that I missed that about the Laughing Fish. I know that I have to give back my Batman fan card. I just goofs on that, fellas. You're absolutely right. Next up, Bucky749 weighed in. He said, these sound like fun stories with Supergirl. I just wish they had done a DC special with the Supergirl's pets. Next up, film historian and network honcho Rob Kelly said, listening to Ann talk Supergirl is like watching, I imagine, Michael Jordan shoot three-pointers. The combo of joy, knowledge, and skill. Regarding the Jim Mooney history, I know Mort Weisinger must have had some good qualities, but I have never heard a single nice story about him ever. Sometime I wonder if his co-credit for creating Aquaman and Green Arrow was just him stealing credit from his artists, knowing he could get away with it. I hear you, Rob. He certainly does not sound like a very nice man, but he was responsible for a lot of great DC stories over the years, and would they have been better or worse without him? It's just hard to say. Back to Rob. Answering your question in the Monthly Planet segment, in 1976, DC was not doing new material in the treasuries and wouldn't until late 1977. The bait and switch that is Superman salutes the bicentennial remains the joke that never gets old. Like, why? It's not like DC didn't have hundreds of pages of Superman goes back in time through American history stories to reprint. I hear you, Rob. Next up, guest from that very episode, Dr. Ange, said, I thought I had commented on the last episode. Shame on me for not. Anyway, loving the Daily Planet section. I think it's fine right here. And I'm a firm believer in doing a Super Team family, but as its own show. Creeper and Wildcat in the story together. Flash and New Gods. Jean Loring going crazy. Alan Weiss drawing Supergirl like Farrah Fawcett. Yes, please. Thanks for the invite. Pleasure to have you, Ange. And since we recorded, I did go and read the whole current Supergirl series on DCUI, and I really enjoyed it. So thanks for pointing me that direction. And I'll come out and say it. I've got to figure out something to do with Super Team Family. I just don't know what to do yet. More to be decided this fall. Next up, Peaceful, Sean Ross said, Paul and Dr. Ange, what a fun episode. I could listen to Ange talk about Supergirl all day. His deep knowledge and love for the character really shines through. The episode also reinforced my love for the current Supergirl series by Sophie Campbell. I find the series fun and charming, but I especially love when Dr. Ange points out all the Easter eggs in the series. Also, I miss Zod in the captain's outfit. It added a bit of creepy camp to the character that I enjoyed. He looked like an extra from Cabaret or The Producers. Great episode. Sean, now I can't get the image of General Zod and The Producers out of my head. Maybe they should get Nathan Lane to play him in the next movie. Anyway, next up, Too Dangerous for the Rest of Us, Martin Gray says, what a splendid issue and a splendid guest. That rich girl who dressed up as Cleopatra, Clarissa, has been in the new Supergirl series a couple of times. As Ange says, this book has a million nods to old continuity. Wow, that's all I have to say, wow. I'm from a mining town. All the men on both sides of the family worked down the mines, and in our house, we had buckets of coal for the two open fireplaces. I was lighting fires from the ages about six. That's just a great tidbit, Martin. Thank you. Back to Martin. Excellent Jim Mooney profile, Paul, and what a fine actor you had to play the great artist. It's a shame to hear he wasn't a big fan of his time on the strip, but yeah, Mort Weisinger. On the subject of that bicentennial action comic story with Clark Kent getting punched back to 1776 and somehow not meeting the Funky Phantom, maybe you're onto something. That issue was, quote, novel length, 17 pages, the climax of the four-parter introducing the villain Carr Brack. So there were three 11-pagers plus the 17-page finale. Maybe the whole sequence was originally meant to headline that Superman salutes his bicentennial, along with a couple of Tomahawk reprints, but wasn't ready in time, so Tom got the full page count. You know, who knows, Martin? And it's another terrific Monthly Planet. Sean, if you hated Crisis on Earth S because Shazam's Squadron of Justice was not an established group, you must have hated Crisis on Earth X. So Paul brought Sean some issues of Superman Family? The best Bronze Age story with the Metal Men was Beware the Brain Children two-parter. See you later, Page Separata. And just to be clear, Martin, I didn't buy Sean any issues of Superman Family. I gave him mine, the ones I bought when I was a kid. So don't read anything into it, at least on my end. Next up, Super Captain. It's the summer of Dr. Ange. I wish I could share his confidence about the upcoming Supergirl film, but I didn't really care for the Women of Tomorrow series. Even though I enjoyed last year's Superman movie, I will have to wait and see with Supergirl. These stories sound fun, and you have to love Supergirl's boyfriend Dick Malvern playing Lois Lane and then scheming to reveal her secret identity. I also like that Lex would turn from heel to hero when needed to protect Lena or help the people of Planet Lexor. Jim Mooney draws quite a lovely Lena Thorall on the panels where she's wearing that red dress. And it's great to see the unholy triad of Phantom Zone villains, Jaxxer, who looks like Lex the Mustache, General Zod, and Kru-El, which is a great apterin. I don't have near the knowledge of the character that Dr. Ange has, but I'm also a fan of the current Supergirl series by Sophie Campbell. Great episode as usual, Paul. Thanks, Super Captain. I appreciate it. Next up, Grandpa Chris Franklin says, fantastic episode, gents. Dr. Ange, of course, was the perfect and really only guest to cover this comic. I have a fondness for the Supergirl backups from reading a few of them in the Best of DC Digest number 17 as an early age. That's when I realized the guy drawing Spectacular Spider-Man had also drawn Supergirl. Is this the first time we see Lex in his later signature colors of green and purple? Although it kind of looks more magenta inside. I don't know. Good question, Chris. Maybe. I'm a sucker for 70s features when readers send in new costume designs, like they did with Robin. Interesting that the powers that be let Supergirl change her look, but Robin only got one issue of Batman Family that he got to adopt those new costumes. But then, Supergirl wasn't on nearly as much merchandise as Robin either, and therefore wouldn't confuse potential customers as much. The creator spotlight on Jim Mooney was great as usual, Paul. One of the oldest comics in my collection is Star Spangled Comics number 99 from December 1949, with a Robin story drawn by Jim Mooney, who's of course the primary artist of that strip too. On the cover, Tomahawk. And the Monthly Planet continues to be a fun addition to the show. I mean, it's Sean, of course it's fun. But before you guys even said who wrote that world's finest story, which I don't believe I've ever read, I said to myself, Haney. Yeah, Chris, I think he's got to tell. Next up, friend of the show, Ido Bosnar, said, what a great issue to cover. I am always fond of these early instances of, quote, trade paperbacks before actual trade paperbacks, meaning books that reprint a complete multi-issue story arc. Personal favorite of mine is that Batman Digest that collects the complete Bat Murderer story. And as usual, I quite enjoyed your creative focus on Jim Mooney. To me, it was particularly interesting to learn that he enjoyed working on Omega for Marvel. However, as you're with your previous show, I find I have more to respond to in the Monthly Planet feature. First, a correction. DC's short-lived Starfire had a grand total of 8 rather than 7 issues. I used to have the whole set back in the day, and I have almost inexplicable fondness for the series, even though it was, as you guys observed, a bit of a mess. 4 writers filed through it, Michelini, Magan, Engelhart, and DeFalco, which created some tonal shifts. The art, however, was quite consistent with Mike Vosburgh on board for the whole series as penciler and Vince Coletta inking all but the first issue. And speaking of Coletta, since you mentioned the Day After Doomsday shorts and World War Tales, it's noteworthy that 2 of them were penciled by Steve Ditko with Coletta inking, and they look surprisingly good. As for other topics, I liked watching Saturday morning's Isis as well, and for me the reason comes down to 2 words, Joanna Cameron. And the revised Metal Men in the 1970s is another personal favorite of mine. Fun stories by Steve Gerber, Jerry Conway, Marty Pasco, and art by Walt Simonson, followed by Joe Staton. It's too bad that only the first 4 issues have ever been reprinted in the Art of Walt Simonson trade paperback. Agree on all counts, Ido. Thanks for the comments. Our old pal, Bat DJ Matthew Davis, said, this was a cool episode. I read some older Supergirl stories as reprints back in the 70s, but not these. I also remember Les Lalar showing up to fight Supergirl and Superman Family at the same time. So back in the 60s, Dick Malvern filled the Lois Lane role and suspected Linda as Supergirl. At the costume party where there's dancing, he comments on how appropriate his Superman outfit is since she's his date. So this means that Dick is fine with an adult male dating his underage cousin? Were they dancing to Jerry Lee Lewis? As for the Monthly Planet segment, the JLA-JSA team-up that year were some of the first issues of JLA I bought, so they hold a sentimental place in my heart. That said, Mr. Scarlet Sidekick has one of the worst names for a sidekick in comics history. Seriously, I cannot hear the word pinky without thinking about SpongeBob's etiquette lessons from Patrick. Thanks, Matthew. Next up, Joe X said, I just read the DC Finest Supergirl, and there are some wild stories in there. Supergirl sabotaging perfectly good adoptive parents and helping other orphans find new parents show that Silver Age DC Child Services didn't always have the children's interests at heart. One thing I've always thought, though, is Supergirl should have an accent. She spent most of her life in Argo speaking Kryptonese, so why wouldn't she? She probably copies Clark's Kansas Metropolis, but needs her own speech pattern, either as Linda or Kara. As for Mon-El, wouldn't taking him to the future and then popping him back to the zone be better? I do think too much about these things. No, Joe, I think you think about this stuff as much as the rest of us. That's pretty normal, right? And a reply to Joe from Martin says, in the DC Rebirth, it was mentioned that she had an accent and didn't use contractions. I don't want her not sounding regular US, though. She's the Supergirl next door. I'm sure her super ears would make getting the accent right easy. Or since all screen Kryptonians seem to be trying to do British, she could be Boston Brahmin. Yeah, I missed that part in DC Rebirth, Martin. I don't recall them pointing it out, but I believe you. I think it's kind of tough to do accents in print kind of in general, unless you start to use and resort to misspellings like this and that that they use for characters like Batroc. It never occurred to me that Wonder Woman would have an accent until Gal Gadot spoke, but it makes sense to me now. I just think it's impractical to see it in comics, but you know, what do I know? Next up, Lizanne Oswald, an impressive podcast, most impressive. Supergirl, I cosplayed as her once. She's cool. And Luthor being able to help his relative is cool. All in the name of family. The other guy, though, he's a jerk. I'm glad Supergirl didn't get stuck with him. Me too, Lizanne. Thanks for writing in. And last but not least, John Steib. Another great episode of DC Special Cast. As usual, Paul and Dr. Ange make me want to read a comic I may actually own and I haven't read, as well as read the current Supergirl series because it received several additional recommendations in this very comment section. I appreciate how the Supergirl comic was essentially one continued story. I thought the reader design costumes were fun too, so the special gallery is appreciated. I, of course, enjoyed the Monthly Planet feature because of the interplay between Paul and Sean. Speaking of those two, I just finished listening to the entire Batman Family Reunion podcast. I cannot say how much fun it was to binge listen to it daily on my walks, on my commute to work and doing yard work. The banter between these two was infectious as it was genuine. I found myself laughing at conversations and running gags from 3 years ago. It was neat to hear early podcast appearances of Brett Young and his fascination with Gotham real estate. But I digress. I'm mentioning it here in case anyone is a fan of DC Special Cast and hasn't listened to Batman Family Reunion. It's definitely worth your time, just like this show. Thanks for everyone involved. I appreciate all your hard work and look forward to the next special episode. Thank you, John. I appreciate the support as always, and I'm even more glad that you enjoyed Batman Family Reunion. That's it for the comments. Thanks to everyone who wrote in. It means a lot to me, and I enjoy reading and responding to all your comments. As always, please leave comments on this episode on the show post of our website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. A reminder that if you're enjoying what you hear on this show or any of our network shows, please consider becoming a patron to help defray the costs. At certain levels, you can get a call out on the show of your choice or suggest an episode to the network. This episode's special thanks go out to our Sunday supporters, Al the Comics Guy, David Gutierrez, Gord Tolton, and Mike Atchison, my guest for next month. To find out more, go to patreon.com/FWpodcasts, and thanks. That'll do it for the feedback section and for this episode. Special thanks to Shag for finally agreeing to be on the show. I think he may have a future in this podcasting biz. Thanks for listening, and I hope you will join me and Mike Atchison next month as we discuss The Star Hunters.